I found 99, first reading of the bill. Senate File 99, first reading of the bill.
Senate File 99, Water and Sewer Districts Elector, sponsored by Senator Christensen, and Act relating to Water and Sewer Districts.
Senate File 99 is referred to Committee Number 7, Corporations. Reports from standing committees.
January the 14th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 9, Private Transfer Fees, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 14th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 34, Law Enforcement Academy Director Duties, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman. January the 14th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 67, Wiretap Authorization, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. I, Senators Burns, Christensen, Escobel, Hicks, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
Consideration of bills on general file. This is Majority Floor Leader. We're at that order of business. Consideration of bills on general file. Whoops. Sorry, do it again. Consideration of bills on general file. This is Majority Floor Leader. We're at that order of business. Consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that we resolve ourselves back into Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Landon.
The Committee of the Whole will please come back to order. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 8. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 8, School Capital Construction Capacity, sponsored by the School Facilities Committee, an act relating to school capital construction. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Barnard, Cole, Landon, and Rotha, Senator Co-Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Cole.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, moving to Committee the Whole, rise and report to do so with the do pass recommendation on Senate File 8. Senate File 8 is brought to you by the Select Committee on School Facilities. This capacity issue started quite some time ago. And just to give a little prelude to that, in capacity, with what we're doing in schools, and we're building a lot of schools, and we're spending a lot of money, and we don't want to build more than we have to build. And so we decided to come up with capacity parameters. So what this bill does, In 2011, the Select Facilities Committee and Legislature modified Facility Needs Index to allow capacity needs to surface on their own merit. And believe me, we've got some districts around the state that are growing again, such that building condition components of the index would not hide bona fide capacity needs. During the 2012 interim, the School Facilities Department initiated building capacity work to develop capacity measurements, guidelines, and requirements. So what this bill does, it codifies the load utilization factors which are used in capacity analysis and building remediation decisions. And we do remediate some schools. We do build some new ones. The numbers, the parameters that we came up with, the load factor is generally precising the elementary school load factor at 100% of space utilization for home rooms with library, music rooms, physical education rooms, hallways not included, because kids get into a room and they stay there all day. The other load factor for middle and high school, we come back and make that an 85% utilization percentage because kids move around from class to class. So that's what the bill does, Mr. Chairman. It's a relatively straightforward bill. It has had a good hard look from the Select Committee on School Facilities. Ask for your support of the bill.
Thank you, Senator. Do I hear a question on the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, we ought to at least talk about something where we spend as much money as we do in school facilities. Let me ask two questions. Now, first question is where you've got a situation where the inner part of the city is losing kids. The neighborhoods are getting older. People are, the kids are grown and they're staying in the same houses and there just aren't the kids in the neighborhood. So if you're running on a strict neighborhood school circumstance, your elementary schools in that area go down in utilization, and the ones out on the fringe that are growing and have lots of young families go way up. Now, my district deals with that with the school of choice, where we can much more easily fill those inner city schools. But not all school districts do. How is that situation impacted by this bill? Second question is, in the previous boom, in my district, we had real capacity problems, and we dealt with those by buying a bunch of temporaries, putting them in and using them for a while. And where you think that your boom may have enrollment may have a peak and may go away, that makes a fair amount of sense. How is that decision impacted by this bill?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To the good senator from Turner County, the short answer to both questions is it's not. It does not affect either movement among schools, which is a district capacity utilization problem of their own. It doesn't affect whether or not you're dealing with temporary schools, which, again, can be looked at by capacity. This is simply setting in statute the ratios that are used for a utilization factor calculation, which determines the full school capacity with regard to what square footage in a school is counted. And based on counting that square footage using a given formula or a specific formula, how much of that square footage gets counted when you're calculating your student capacity. There were some proposals of variations on this, in 87.5% for high schools, 95% for homerooms in elementary schools, that went back and forth. Based on the recommendations we heard, we arrived at this being, with these numbers, as being the best. So it's basically a nuance of the calculation of how many students a school can fit, but doesn't really directly affect the concerns, the policy concerns that you're talking about, which would be within district type considerations. Thank you, Mr. President, or Chairman.
Senator Rebell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what my questions deal with on the capacity side, the first one is, we have the issue of K through 3, 16 and under capacity. Is there any relationship in this? Probably not, but I'd like to have you speak to that. And the other thing is, what's the practicality of it? When you go to page 3 and you look at lines 4 through 10, What does that mean to a school that's out there that's going through the design phase, that's looking at the capacity requirements, and they figured that they should build a school based on a certain number of students? Does that affect that and the way they've calculated that? If some of these are in the process, I know we've got 23, 24, 25 schools out there that we're talking about going to the construction phase, the build and design phase, whatever. Is this kind of a language going to affect that and what they're doing, how they're calculating their capacity?
Senator Cole.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it was last year, I hope I'm right in saying this, but we came out with when we debated the Natrona issue to try to deal with projected revenue, projected enrollment increases, and we came, I believe, and talked about being able to do that for 5 years. And we had a big debate about that. We didn't know how far out we wanted to go. So I don't think it has much of an effect on it. To answer your first question, the 16-to-1 in K-3, that's something we have in statute. That's something that the School Facilities Commission deals with right now. So these parameters of 85% in middle and high school and 100% utilization in K-6 fall under those parameters. So K-3, it would have an effect on the 16-to-1. There's no question about that.
Senator Rothfuss.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Good questions there, particularly the 16-to-1. I follow up on what my chairman said. They're referring to it basically as a restricted utilization factor, where a room size might be able to hold, we'll say, 21 kids in the room. When they calculate the 100% utilization factor for homerooms, they will assume they've only got one room. That room can only hold 16 students because we restrict them, and that would represent a 100% use. So there's no access to those other five students when they calculate the utilization factor with regard to the square footage. When you're planning new schools, it changes things a little bit, and it determines how many square feet you would want to use for a classroom is one calculation based on that 16-to-1 concept. And then the utilization factor comes into play different ways depending on when you're talking about junior high schools and high schools or the elementary schools, which is why we have two different rates. For the elementary, they only count homerooms, which is why you have a 100% utilization factor. And why, when you're calculating it for a school, you would plan the school based on 100% usage. In other words, how many elementary school homeroom classrooms am I going to need? That determines the capacity for the school, and you basically disregard all of the rest of the school's square footage when you're calculating the capacity because you can't use it effectively. You have to have a homeroom for those kids. You can't have double use. When you look at a high school, you recognize that kids are moving around and that there's no way to fully use the entire space of the school. So they calculate the space differently, recognizing that sometimes kids will be in gyms, sometimes kids will be in cafeterias. They're floating around, and they calculate that utilization factor a little bit differently. They still have some excluded space. They're still working on some restricted formulae to recognize similar things like that 16-to-1 ratio and that you can't have 1,000 kids in a gym at a time, even if that's what the square footage would provide. But at the same time, they're recognizing that with the kids floating around, you have to calculate it differently, and the 85% factor is, again, a fairly common one that's used nationwide as a, you have a good bit of space, it's not overly restrictive, it's not also ridiculously low. If you're on a block schedule, you need something closer to 70%. So this is a difficulty for schools that use a block schedule, and they were ones that wanted it to go to a lower utilization factor. It's a compromised position that tries to make sure that we have plenty of space for the kids. To the question that the good senator from Fremont County asked a little while ago, yes, this is used when you're calculating the space for school capacity if you're planning a new high school as well. You'll use that 85% utilization factor and basically come up with the number of square feet you need for a given population of kids estimated. and then you'll divide by that utilization factor to come up with the number of square feet that would be acceptable is more or less how that utilization factor comes into play in a formulaic sense.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm still trying to figure out how this is used. Let me give you a hypothetical example, Mr. Chairman. Suppose you're a relatively small school district. You've got an elementary school in a community that you've got two of each grade. And suppose in one of these grades where the ratio is 16 to 1, you've got a capacity of 32. Suppose you've actually got 38 kids. Are you allowed to put three extra kids in each of those two classrooms and have 19 in each class? Or is this strictly for advanced planning for the future? And then I have the same question. Suppose you were a large district and had a two-unit school in the on the edge of town, and you've got the extra kids. Are you then forced to send them to some other school to meet the capacity of things, or again, is it strictly a planning function?
Senator Rothfuss.
It is more of a planning function, and the governing statute would go back to the 16 to 1 that we have in the model where we make the requirement, and this would not affect that theoretically. This, going with the restricted model, each of those classrooms would still be restricted to 16 to 1, and therefore you would technically be over capacity, regardless of how large those classrooms were, based on the student-to-teacher ratio. Now, that's another point, is it's based on the student, not necessarily the classroom, but there is an acknowledgement that if you have a classroom sized to a maximum of 25 kids, you obviously can't fit two classes in there, and that's where the restricted model comes from. Regarding the whether it's closer to the edge of town or whether it's just for planning, it really does go more towards the planning and the square footage that you're going to need per kid when you're looking at the capacity of your school district. So I guess the policy answer wouldn't be from this legislation, but it would be from the previous statute, which is that, yes, technically you would have to move those kids, but then again you could go for the waiver if there was undue hardship. The short answer, Mr. Chairman, if there was one, is that this wouldn't affect those considerations.
Mr. Vice President. Senator Coe.
Mr. Chairman, the 85% has pretty much been general out there all along. We haven't changed that. The 100% was where we had the debate, and that went a lot back to the 16-to-1 discussion we just had. But the 85% exists out there, and it's pretty uniform across the country.
Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm still confused as to whether or not we're changing the rules midstream. We've got some schools, particularly some elementary schools that we're trying to build here in Laramie County. Does this bill in any way say, whoops, you got to go back to the drawing board again, and now we've delayed that process?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, that's a good question. I'm sorry, I probably should have pointed that out earlier. This is very much consistent with what we are doing and what we have been doing. We haven't heard any expectation of anyone changing. The board made some recommendations on the high school and junior high that were actually increasing the restriction that could have diminished the square footage, but this statute puts into effectively law what we have been doing. So, but the answer would be no, to the best of my knowledge.
Senator Von Flater.
And I tell you, this also helps in Campbell County. They did some capacity studies, and when they realized that you had, you know, 1,000 square feet and that should have handled 20 kids, but you only had 18 children, they said, well, your schools aren't overcrowded. But the little school up in the town of Recluse only had 50 kids in it, and it could hold 75, but we had one junior high that was 110% of capacity. But you had all the square footage together, and and all the students together, you had enough square footage, but you had 40 miles between the two schools. So this school still needs to be rebuilt. And so by putting 85% in there, we guarantee that they don't look at a school and say, you still have 4% more room in it, especially in high school where they move about between the gym and the cafeteria. So this is putting into statute what they already practice. But in our case, it really does settle an argument.
Senator Anderson, District 28.
Question is the 85% and the 100% numbers common architecture calculations in the calculations that they use, or is that a deviation from what they normally use?
Senator Cole.
Mr. Chairman, that's pretty much standard if you look at school construction. And I think what we're really doing with this bill is just recognizing what is standard out there and putting it in statute.
Any other questions? Do I hear a question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 8, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay? The bill has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 13. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 13, Uniform Commercial Code Revision, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, and Act relating to the Uniform Commercial Code. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivision, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Case, Hines, Johnson, Nutting, and Scott, Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Case.
Mr. Chairman, I'm so excited to move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a do-pass recommendation on Senate File 13. This is a big, thick old bill that's going to be even more exciting than the last one we talked about, has no amendments, and I'd like to yield to the tall, interesting-looking fellow from Natrona County.
Well, that's Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, this is a joint committee bill. It's the work of the Uniform Law Commission, Uniform Commercial Code, and it is an area where we do seek to have uniformity among the several states, so that as you do commercial transactions, you've got a standard set of law that you're dealing with. It makes the world a lot simpler for people who are borrowing and lending. And it is of great interest, probably, this bill, only to people who are in the business of lending people money. I will say that it is in their interest to have a simple and uniform procedure. And it's particularly important here because they're trying to find out if something is offered for security, has it already been pledged or is it free and clear? And so there's a lot of importance in the ability to search databases for names and finding out what has been pledged and what hasn't. I would say it's very much in the interest of anybody who's borrowing money that there be an efficient process for the lender to find out is the collateral that you're offering free and clear or is it encumbered. So both sides, I think, have an interest in this particular legislation. What this legislation does, and we had testimony from the Secretary of State's office who brought this to our attention because they're the ones that for a lot of this paper is filed in Wyoming and similar places elsewhere. And from the Deputy State Auditor, Kogan, who is a member of the Uniform Law Commission, the Joint Committee heard from actually an expert from Kentucky who actually drafted a lot of this, and it has been worked over pretty carefully. I did speak to the representative from the Bankers Association who thought that this was in good shape. I'll cite just a couple of examples of things that it does. Fairly typical of the sort of thing you find in this. If you look on page 16, line 6 of the bill, you will find a reference to electronic chattel paper. This is the world is changing since the last time this particular section of statute was revised. You go into a big automobile or bill dealer right now, the paper may well be electronic rather than in physical form. It's just a more efficient way to do business. The statute needs to recognize that. That's what you see starting on line 6 on page 16. I will mention something else that is of particular interest. Page 33, line 1 through page 35, line 7. We're getting a problem with certain people out there who don't particularly like the democratic process and are really oppressing elected officials they don't like with floods of false filings, of claims and liens and all that sort of thing. This gives a mechanism for somebody who's been hit by one of those to put in an information statement saying, look, disregard that, it's not true. That area is a problem. This is a start on that problem, but frankly, I think we're going to need, and I think somebody is working on, much more vigorous legislation in this particular area because that problem has come to Wyoming. So this is taking a first step in that area. There's a lot of technical changes in the bill, otherwise trying to standardize names and things like that so you can search electronically for information. I do have a listing of 20 specific points in this bill, which I'd be happy to discuss at length with the Senate. Happy to give to anybody that wants it. I can get a copy made. The Secretary of State's office furnished. But I will do that only, Mr. Chairman, if somebody wants to. Frankly, I think this bill is in good shape. It will help our commercial lending business make credit more easily available. I understand that 30 states have already adopted this version of it, so this is needed to keep us uniform. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator Scott. Mr. Vice President.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. One quick question on your list of 20 is, are airplanes included as, you know, how you perfect security and what you do for security rather than going through the FAA in Oklahoma City, or is the state of Wyoming stepping up to do another way to perfect that security?
Senator Scott?
If the standard now is to go through the FAA on those things, that will continue to be. We aren't stepping out on anything new that 30 other states haven't already done. So my belief is that nothing changes for airplanes. I don't recall that as being discussed at all. If that's the standard way you do it now, that's the standard way you'll continue to do it. Because if it had been changed in the other states, you'd have heard about it.
Any other questions, comments on Senate File 13? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 13, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Senate File 13 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 30. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 30, Special District, sponsored by the Revenue Committee, and Act relating to special districts.
Thank you.
It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28, Senators Case, Emmerich, Peterson, Von Flader, and Senator Peterson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the Senate file. What is your pleasure? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the committee of the whole rises to report that it do so with the favorable recommendation on Senate File 30, and there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask for that to be read in at this time.
Senate File 3, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 17.
I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, Mr. Chairman, to Senate File 30. And for a further explanation on this good bill, I would refer to Senator Anderson.
Senator Anderson, District 28.
The amendment first is the we found on page 2, line 17, we required each special district, no matter how formed, to report, and we found out that we needed to add except districts created by and subject to administration by the courts. We found out that the irrigation districts do not report through this system. They report through the courts. So that would be an exception to that requirement.
Any questions on the Standing Committee Amendment? Do you want to dispose of that, Senator, at this time?
Yes, please.
Do I hear a question on the amendment? Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment to Senate File 30, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. Okay, we are back on the bill. Senator Anderson.
This bill is all about transparency in state government. What's been pointed out to the committee is that there's about $800,000 in these special accounts, special district accounts, that nobody really knows what is going on with them. There is appears to be $152,000 restricted and $177,000 assigned. What this bill hopes to do is have all the information that they normally fill out now go to the state auditor. The state auditor will then report back to the county commissioners in a concise report that they can look at and post on their website or in their public information, however they do that. And so the public can see how many dollars they're spending, how many they're bringing in, and how many they're saving in each area. So the county commissioners see this information, but it's kind of in a generic form that they can't really identify every special district. So it's not asking the special districts to do anything new as far as reporting. It's asking the state auditor to compile the reports.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, and I'm really coming back. We've now put an exception in for the irrigation districts. You know, it sounds like we've got the court doing some kind of executive branch supervision function that's not really appropriate for a court. Why should the irrigation district substantively be different from all the other special districts?
Senator Von Flader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the best way I can answer that to the tall senator from Natrona County is that the district courts actually would disperse or rule upon an irrigation district different than a special district being anything from a homeowners association up through a large water district. So that's why they asked that that be removed, because there is some language in here that says the commissioners may not fund that special district. Well, if it's district courts that have the the control over an irrigation district, you got a collision of two authorities there. That's why they were exempted.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was had a question on page 3, and this is on lines, I guess, 8 and 9, in that vicinity, 8, 9, 10 maybe, where it talks about the posting of the budget shall include the date, time, and location of a special district budget session during which final action will be taken on the proposed budget. Well, I guess I'm trying to figure out who will be taking the final action. Will it be the districts taking the final action there? I wasn't quite sure. Will it be the commissioners taking the final action? Because I don't know if I ever remember taking any final action on a district budget. So I'm just wondering who that – would you describe that?
Senator Von Flater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is the special districts, and what they're asking is that when the commissioners have received it for final action by the districts, the special districts, that also the time will be posted on that website when that special district will take action upon its budget.
Senator Cole.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm kind of struggling with this bill, and I've been both a little bit. I was a county commissioner, and then I was very active in the fire district up in Cody. My recollection of how you create a special district is you take it to a vote of the people, and they vote it in. And then they're allowed, and then you vote for trustees at that special district. And then, as my experience as a county commissioner, the only function that we really performed as it related to that special district was done after we got the county assessed valuation, and particularly in that special district. So if you're allowed in a fire district to levy up to 3 mills, if they bring a budget to you, the only function I remember doing as a county commissioner was to make sure that their proposed budget matched up with the assessed valuation. So I'm a little bit concerned about this bill. I'm not quite sure why we're doing it. These are elected trustees on these special districts. You know, West Park Hospital up in my country has a $100+ million budget. The 3 mills that they collect is a small part of what they do. But one of the other questions I have here is the Board of County. It says if a proposed budget is not provided, this is on page 3, line 10, if a proposed budget is not provided as required by that statute, the Board of County Commissioners may not approve funding of the special district mill levy. I just don't understand how a Board of County Commissioners can do that with a special district that is created by a vote of the people with elected trustees. Would somebody please enlighten me?
Senator Von Flater.
I seem to be the one jumping up first, Mr. Chairman, so thank you for that recognition. It says may. So it is in line 11, page 3, where it says the Board of County Commissioners may not approve funding. So, you know, it's up to you to trust your board, your county commissioners. I can't imagine that they'd mess with something as large as your hospital. That wouldn't happen. What this was intended to do was to incentivize those special districts that are not filing their budgets, that are not having meetings, to actually get together, have their meetings, the county commissioners to have some oversight, which they do presently, because, as you said, they do assess a mill, and they need to make sure their budget comes in within that mill that they've the amount of the assessment, so that the special district isn't over budgeting. So they do have some oversight over it. So this just says they may. It could have been a shell, and I think the committee would have shot that down too. So it's to incentivize those small districts that are not complying with any of the regulations to get the reports in on time, the commissioners to budget the money appropriately, the state to know about it, and the report to be put on a website so the public can see what they're doing, what they're spending their money on, how much money they have, which most people in small special districts would, people outside of it, even people that live in it, would have no idea what their special district has because they don't get involved enough themselves.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, my concern on about this bill is actually pretty much the same concern as the good senator from Cody, except it's from the opposite end. The large districts, you know, such as a $100 million hospital and so forth, they have elected trustees that everybody in the district, which was probably the entire county, pay attention to and keep an eye on. My concern is for the really small districts, special improvement district like a homeowners association, a special district for some irrigation improvement. I'm involved in one that put a tunnel through Tunnel Hill in Story that I pay into. And the problem that we've had forever, and I'm sure it's all over the state, is actually finding people who are willing to do the work, willing to count the money and keep the books and all that. And now we're going to be adding another burden onto those particular people who are good enough to volunteer for this. They're already counting the money as it comes in. If you've got a homeowners association or something like that, fine, they can try and do the budget, but they don't know how many times it's going to snow and how many times they're going to have to pay for somebody to plow the subdivision road or something like that. And I've really got some problems with the idea of having to set the budget ahead of time, especially when the amount of the money is set. It's set by the mill levy of the county, and most special districts have to live with the amount of money that is coming in. So I'm trying to figure out what problem we're trying to solve with this by trying to put the budget in ahead of time.
Senator Cooper, you were first up, and we'll come to Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, well, the way that works, senators, is districts usually have a range or a maximum amount of mill levy that they're allowed to impose upon the taxpayers of the district. For example, a fire district might have, a 2.5 or 3 mill levy, for example. Well, that doesn't mean that they have to budget every year for 3 mills. It might be, in the case of our county, we've got a large mineral industry and coal mining and so forth. You know, 1 mill represents a whole ton, of money. And so a little fire district may only need to use 1.2 mills out of the 3 mills, for example. Well, the commissioners look at the budget as from that district every year when they bring it in to the commission to review it, and they say, okay, they request 1.2 mills. They don't let them request the whole 3 mills if that's not what they need. They may need 3 mills if they buy a bunch of new fire trucks or something, but generally they don't. And so that the commissioners are tasked with the responsibility of kind of keeping that budget in control, or the mill levy in control, with their actual budget. So in the end analysis, that's what the review is all about, and that's how that works.
Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, as I recall the discussion, the main thing about it is accountability. If you look up, special districts have in the statutes, they can total up to about 70 mills. But most people have no idea what their budgets are or what their, some of them are voted on, some of them are strictly up to the county commissioners. And the idea is to have their budgets sent in where it's on the website public so people knows how much each one are spending. The way it is now, if you could find out, you'd have to go to all these different special districts and look up their paperwork and see where they're filed, you know. But the main thing is to get the whole thing together on a website so there are accountability, where the general public can look at that and see how much is spent and where it is budgeted in each one of these mill levies. Because like they said, some of the mill levies are set by statute and they just give them the full mills. Other ones they are allowed up to 3 mills, but the commissioners decide how many mills they'll get. So it basically go down to accountability. So there's some site that where the general public can look at and not have to spend a huge amount of time finding out where all the money is going.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Accountability is great, and it's also the transparency. We've talked about that already. I don't want to reiterate that, harp on that a lot. We have technology. that's still relatively pretty new to our counties, and that's their websites, and that's what we're asking them to do is post these forms, these findings, these reports on the website. And the reason for that is, again, transparency. Having served as a county commissioner, Mr. Chairman, for 8 years, I can and tell you that the review of these special districts in our particular county, 70-some-odd special districts, is very loose. When we don't live in those specific areas, as long as their budget comes in and everything balances, we're happy. But we've had some instances up in our particular area, and I'm sure that other good senators here would experience the same thing if they would check into it, is that some of these special districts, when you're talking about the number of 70 or more, we had a cemetery district purchasing exercise equipment. I don't know. I mean, I always thought that dead people were dead and they didn't need the exercise equipment. Later finding out the amount of money was being loaned to the local rec district from the cemetery district. Now, that's just misappropriation of funds, Mr. Chairman. The commissioners didn't catch that. So, and you talk to any of your residents on the street of something that's happening that you hear about of a special district in their area, and most likely they'll say, I wasn't aware of that, but that doesn't sound right to me. So this posting on the website is critical. There's nothing wrong with this bill. It's a good transparency bill, and I'd urge your support of it.
Senator Cole first, then we'll come back to the sponsor. Senator Cole.
In answer to my good friend from Gillette over there, I don't think it makes any difference whether it's Mayor Schell. I don't think either one of them apply, really, to be honest with you, because what we're really doing with that particular sentence there is we're saying that the elected county commissioners can go in to another elected board elected by the people and either fund them or not fund them. Now, I don't think that should happen, and I don't think it can really happen. So that's my really major concern with this bill. I understand the problem where some people lose track of districts. We get our tax bill in the mail, and they tell you what you pay for the cemetery district. They tell you what you pay for the soil conservation district. They tell you what you pay for the hospital district, the fire district, irrigation districts, all of that. But I still think that as that special district is created and is allowed to levy up to so many mills, the job of the county commissioners is only to make sure they live within the parameters of the assessed valuation, and their budget isn't higher than that. In other words, if you apply 3 mills to their valuation, and I've actually done this where we've cut them back. They brought a budget to us. We limit it to 3 mills, get the assessed valuation of the district, and cut it back to what those 3 mills will levy.
Thank you.
So I have major concerns with this bill. I know it's in good intention to disclose, but I ask that you be very careful.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the component about posting this on the website, but this goes much further than that. What we now have done is basically said we're going to put the county commissioners in a regulatory environment to oversee and supersede decisions made by other elected boards. Let me give you a little real-life scenario here. Carbon County is a big county, and it's geographically isolated and diverse. I'm pretty sure that the people over there in Medicine Bow really don't have a lot of interest in what the Savory Museum District is doing with their mill levy. Let's talk about the accountability component of this. Those people are accountable for every single dollar they spend because they're collected as part of the tax base. If they're not following the laws, they can be prosecuted under the laws of the state of Wyoming. So the accountability exists already. We heard testimony that some of these counties have 70 special districts. And what you're basically saying with this bill is now the county commissioners are responsible for overseeing the budget of 70 different special districts. You put this in, not only do you give them oversight, you give them liability associated for how those funds are going to be expended. Because now the county commissioners have to say, I'm approving that budget. You've taken that decision-making ability away from that locally elected board, and you're housing that responsibility for that budget back onto the county commissioners. I think this, while I understand the intent, and I think the intent is good of this accountability component, I think it certainly opens a lot of questions as far as who's liable If you take that responsibility away from those elected officials and house it with another elected official, I think we just need to be careful with what we're doing here.
Senator Anderson, 28.
Mr. Chairman, I think some of the things we're hearing here are some of the things we heard in committee as to what's not happening. I was just reviewing the law, and the Board of County Commissioners is already responsible for these special districts. So I don't think that's really anything new, and that's what the bill is trying to get at, is some of that is not being done in some of the 23 counties. Reporting is already being done to the state auditor, and there's only 9 districts by this paper that are not reporting. So all of them are already reporting. The problem isn't in the new reporting, as the Lake DeSmit Tunnel man referred to. There's not any new reporting requirements on this. The requirement is that someone look at it, and the public can look at it and say, what is this special district spending their money on?
Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just briefly, since all the other county commissioners seem to have waited in on this one, we got one more. It's just, he may not have an opinion on this. Mr. Chairman, if we look at this, the county commissioners in this, I don't think want, nor do they have the power under this bill to approve or not approve a budget. If we read the language carefully, it just simply says if a proposed budget is not provided, then the county commissioners have the right to take this action. So I think we have to be, like always, we've got to be careful about, you know, not seeing things that go bump in the night when they're not there. So the only thing that I think this bill does, as I understand it and read it, is simply the commissioners commissioners have the authority not to approve the mill levies going forward if that budget's not approved. I don't think there's anything in this bill that gives them oversight, the ability to change the budget or approve the budget. They simply look at it and verify that it's been given. If it hasn't been given, then I think there is some language. I think there is probably maybe some ambiguity about whether May on page 3 at line 11 is actually a mandatory May or a discretionary May, but and that may actually go bump in the night, Mr. Chairman, but in doing this, you know, and having seen this, it gets to be those situations. It is. It's true that you're looking for volunteers to run these boards, and it's a thankless job, probably even more thankless than being a county commissioner. But the other side of that is this is real money. It's real tax money, and you find situations where things are being spent not appropriately. The public does have the right to disclosure. If there isn't disclosure and the ability to understand that, you know, then I think that any move that we can have towards transparency is a good thing. And I think you need to look at this bill carefully, and I think it's intended to do a good thing. And right now I think that the Revenue Committee's done a good job with it.
Thank you, Senator. Any other comments? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Peterson, excuse me, I apologize. We do have another amendment, a committee of the whole amendment, I believe. Would the reading clerk please read in the amendment?
Senate File 3, Committee Amendment of the Whole, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1, page 3, line 7.
Senator Anderson, would you like to move that? I'm sorry. Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, without objection, I withdraw that amendment.
Without objection, that amendment has been withdrawn. We are back on the bill. Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, and to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 30, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 30 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 31. The reading clerk will read in the bill.
Senate File 31, Wyoming Veterinarian Medical Practice Act, sponsored by the Agriculture Committee, an act relating to veterinarians. It was referred to Committee Number 5, Agriculture, State, Public Lands, and Water Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson. Senator Geis, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Mr. Vice President?
Mr. Chairman, may I have privilege of the floor?
Mr. Vice President, you may.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, the Appropriations Committee was scheduled to meet at 3 o'clock, and we'll let the House do that. The Senate Appropriations Committee will be asked to stay in here for Committee of the Whole.
Thank you. We are back on Senate File 31. You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that Senate File 31 do pass, and I'd like to have the Standing Committee Amendment read in.
Senate File 31, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 5, line 7.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 and yield the floor to Senator Emmerich.
Senator Emmerich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, I bring to you a real killer of a bill. What it amounts to, I say I bring to you a real killer of a bill. This bill is in reference to the Euthanasia Technicians Board. It was a board formed, I believe, in 2004. There have only been 61 people certified, and there are only 30 that hold current certificates. A euthanasia technician is one that works for law enforcement, either a sheriff's department, an animal shelter, things of that sort. And they are enabled to, by this board, to euthanize animals without a veterinarian doing the actual operation. In the 10 years of this board, it has not been able to financially support itself. And as a matter of fact, as boards sometimes do, it has fallen rather flat. The Board of Veterinary Medicine has indicated that they probably should take over this board because they're a more financially stable and solid board. And that's precisely what this bill does. It eliminates the Euthanasia Technician Board and all the funds that are still available would go to the Board of Veterinary Medicine. And I think you'll notice on the fiscal note it's $1,000 or something of that sort. As to the amendments, page 5, line 1, this is merely clearing up some potential problems. After, let's see, page 5, line 7, after animal, we are deleting the remainder of the lines on 7 and 8 in reference to euthanizing drugs. The process of a euthanization of an animal does not always involve drugs, and so we're just referring to the act of providing humane death. On the same page, page 5, we are removing the term phenobarbital-based drug because not all euthanasia drugs are phenobarbital-based. So it removes a very narrowing part of the statute that really is not needed. Mr. Chairman, I would stand for any questions.
Senator, would you like to dispose of that standing committee amendment at this time?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I believe the chairman has already moved the amendment.
Question on the amendment? All those in favor of Senator Geis's motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 31, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. The Standing Committee Amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, could the floor manager of the bill explain to me, first of all, I guess, what it takes to become a euthanasia technician? How much education is involved in that? Where would one go to get that certification? And the other question I have is, frankly, is trying to figure out why you need all the certification to basically euthanize an animal. I mean, I don't know why training couldn't be done at the local animal shelter or at the vets.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Emmerich.
In response to the good senator's question, most euthanasia training is overseen by veterinarians when they are using specific drugs, and in most cases animal shelters and impoundments use drugs. The training is usually provided in about 4 to 6 hours by veterinarians, and the fact of why they are even employed, if I understand your question correctly, is the fact that no veterinarian is available at the time when they are in the needs of euthanizing sick or unwanted animals.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, curious why, so a vet is actually training somebody to euthanize the animals for the local animal shelter or whatever, because that's not available. I'm trying to figure out all these exclusions. Why does it make a difference whether the euthanasia applicant has a felony conviction or not? Or a number of these other things, like moral turpitude, for instance, which I interpret, I'm sure it's in statute, but I interpret it as being, for instance, on the on the sex offender list or something like that. I'm trying to figure out why they would. I can understand the conviction for cruelty in animals, but these other things, I don't know. Why would we exclude these people from a job such as this?
Senator
Chairman, most of this relates, Senator, to the availability of. These are usually considered to be class 2 drugs that have potential for abuse. And so the Board of Pharmacy, as well as the Board of Veterinary Medicine, goes through this complete litany of who may qualify for such a thing. It's just not a matter of giving a euthanizing drug or administering some other valid means of euthanasia, but it is primarily concerned with the availability of drugs. And this is where we've added a lot of the statutes which are related to the Board of Veterinary Medicine and some of the statutes involving the Board of Pharmacy.
Question having been called, all those in favor of Senator Geis's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 31, please say aye. All opposed, no. Senate File 31 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 64. The reading clerk will read the bill.
Senate File 64, Wholesale Malt Beverage Distributors Limitation, sponsored by Senator Coe, and Act Relating to Alcohol Licensing. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 28. Aye, Emmerich and Peterson. No, Senators Case and Von Flader and Senator Peterson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with the favorable recommendation on Senate File 64. There are no standing committee amendments, and I would refer the explanation of the bill, further explanation of the bill, to the good senator from Park County.
Senator Coe.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senate File 64, Wholesale Malt Beverage Distributors, Limitations. I bring this bill to you. It's a bill that is pro-Wyoming business that protects and attempts to enhance our three-tier system in the malt beverage category of alcohol distribution, which is similar to the way we do wine and spirits. You know, you have people that, wineries outside the state, distillers outside the state, they're the manufacturers. They bring that to the State Liquor Commission. And then the State Liquor Commission distributes that to the local businesses out there. Senate File 64 on limitations, Mr. Chairman. This bill closes a loophole in our current statutes that allow a brewery to hold a malt beverage, a brewery being from outside the state, to hold a malt beverage wholesale distribution license. Like I alluded to, Wyoming has a true three-tier system of alcohol licensure in the wine and spirits category. The distiller or winery is the manufacturer, the state's the distributor, and the retail liquor establishment is where the final transaction occurs with the consumer. In the malt beverage category, with Wyoming statutes attempt to have a three-tier system, but in essence, it is really a two-tier system. So what Senate File 64 attempts to do is make it clear that breweries should not be involved in the distribution tier as a licensed wholesale distributor. So it does this by two things in the bill. It adds a limitation on language in 12.2.101A with new subsections little I and 2 little I. This language prohibits a non-resident malt beverage manufacturer from having any interest in the business assets of a licensee. It does add a temporary exception to that prohibition under special circumstances in the language starting on page 2, line 15. That's pretty much the bill, Mr. Chairman. I would go ahead and try to cover why the three-tier system is good for Wyoming. First, it ensures that all proper taxes are paid on products to federal, state, and local governments. Second, it provides a system of checks and balances between all the tiers of the distribution system, making it easy to identify any bad actors or companies trying to circumvent the system. Third, it allows the American consumer to enjoy unparalleled choice. We all want unparalleled choice. And variety in types and brands of alcohol. Nearly 13,000 brands of beer are available to American consumers. Fourth, it offers a path to market for small suppliers who otherwise would not have the manpower or infrastructure to efficiently distribute and sell their products, this being the small microbreweries. And last, it keeps the business of alcohol distribution local. Licensed beverage distributors are members of the community who are familiar with the local attitudes and concerns regarding their products. They sponsor a number of responsibility programs and initiatives in their communities. I would draw your attention to the handout I distributed. All of the wholesale distributors in the state of Wyoming support this bill. I draw your attention to this handout right here that I sent out on Senate File 64. Ask for support of the bill and stand for questions.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill came through the Revenue Committee, which, of course, I'm a member, and I wasn't persuaded in the committee that this bill was a good idea. Mr. Chairman, I should also clarify that I'm not in the bar business anymore, Mr. Chairman. I am sort of familiar from this industry from both sides of the bar, actually, to tell you the truth. But, Mr. Chairman, there's a lot to this that you're looking at, and there's more than meets the eye. And I think we got to understand kind of what we're getting into. One of the things is, of course, about the Constitution and the constitutionality of this bill. Now, I caused to be distributed on the floor a memo that I requested from our LSO staff. If you'll see it, it's an LSO memorandum. It says Senate File 64. It's got my name in it. Pertains to this bill. Mr. Chairman, the gist of this is, constitutionally, can we say you can't have anyone from out of state own this business? Now, if it was a hotel or a restaurant and didn't have anything to do with alcohol, there would not be any question. The U.S. Constitution wouldn't allow you to say you can only sell this business to people that live in Wyoming by law. Now, you could have that in a contract or possibly a covenant or something that's private, but you can't do that by law. That's exactly what this law, this bill is proposing to do. And so now the question is, because this involves alcohol, can you do that? And you see, the whole deal with alcohol, we got in a big old mess because we had a constitutional amendment which restricted the delivery of alcohol. And then we had another constitutional amendment which made it legal again. And so by the factors that it was made legal again, states were giving broad ability to regulate alcohol and regulate alcohol to the detriment of other constitutional provisions. So that's why you get things like, you know, one of my favorites is you can't have nude dancing where alcohol is served in some places. Darn, I think that's a great shame, Mr. President, but it's because the free expression, free speech aspect of nude dancing conflicts with the state's higher ability to regulate alcohol. That's where that comes about. And this memo explains that, by and large, the courts have interpreted the state's interest in the alcohol control higher than the rest of the constitutional provisions fairly significantly until the 1960s. And then there's been a shift where more and more aspects of constitutionality have been required to come into compliance. One of the really basic ones is this issue about estate ownership. And if you look at the bottom of this memo from our LSO, it talks about a Kansas case that was exactly on point, trying to restrict sales to out-of-state persons and restricting the out-of-state. That's what this whole thing hinges on, and it's unconstitutional with respect to the Commerce Clause. Okay? So that should be all of it. But I'll submit to you that there is a little bit more to this. Under our own alcoholic beverage statutes, that would be a Title 12, Alcoholic Beverages, Chapter 9, that's where we talk about malt beverages, and there's an article there that covers the relationship between malt beverage distributors and manufacturers. It's 12.9.101. I encourage you to go and look that statute up and scroll through and see how detailed that relationship is and the great protections that are offered our distributors, our malt beverage distributors across Wyoming, including lots of ownership restrictions. So what I would suggest to you that a lot of this is not being done for the benefit of the consumer. What we really have are different levels of monopoly. Your beer distributor, your malt beverage distributor, is a monopoly for that particular area. The producer of the beer, the brewer, the big brewing company, is a monopoly as well. So we're kind of we're being asked to enter into the clash of a couple of different monopolies. I fail to see where the consumer is benefited in any particular way, and I think that I'd ask you to reject this bill, and I specifically would ask you to reject it because of the constitutionality issue. Now, I just talked about the Commerce Clause before, but there are other aspects of the Constitution that can be discussed as well, things like equal protection, interfering in business contracts, those issues, just as violated by this proposal. And it won't hold up in court. It's an attempt to continue monopoly. It's not really even in the best interest of the beer distributors in the long run because it limits who they can sell to. Mr. Chairman, this is a bad bill, and I suspect we ought to get rid of it.
Senator Bebout.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Member of the Senate, this is a good bill. And a couple of things that my colleague for Fremont County talked about, the monopoly, and it's a lot different in my way of thinking a monopoly that's one of the major beer distributors in the world versus one of the local guys in Fremont County that distributes the beer, so I think that's not a fair comparison. When we talk about the consumer benefits, one thing for sure, if one of these huge, huge international producers of malt beverages, in fact, owns a distributorship, whose beverage are they going to distribute? Are they going to talk to the various small people in Wyoming, like the microbreweries, and give them an ample opportunity on their truck to carry their beer, or are they just going to carry their particular brand? I think I know what the answer to that is. And I find myself, it's hard to argue constitutionally, but the question I would have is, and I read the Kansas decision, and it says, because it prohibits non-resident individuals or any corporation, da-da-da-da, from obtaining a Kansas license to distribute liquor. So is the state of Wyoming violating the interstate commerce by what we're doing with distilled beverages? We've been doing that forever, and that's exactly what we do in the state of Wyoming. We distribute those beverages, so I guess why has it anyway challenged the state of Wyoming? Another thing that I would consider as a fair comparison is the contractor's preference law, and we do 5% in Wyoming. And as I understand it, that's been challenged under the Interstate Commerce Clause as not being constitutional, and that has survived. So I think the constitutional argument really doesn't weigh in on this as much as this document would say. The other thing that I would talk about, and I get lost in the temperance and the three levels of that, but I do know there's a three-tier system and a two-tier system, and that the one particular brewery has decided to live by the three-tier system. Another one has not. And I think Wyoming should have the three-tier system, and I think this bill does that, and that's another reason why I support the bill.
Senator Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, a minute ago we referred to the LSO memo, and we really we heard a lot about the first three quarters, or, well, 90% of it, but I just draw your attention to the last two lines on the last page, where it says the bill provides an exemption from stringent residency requirements that is not currently available, and one could argue that makes the current law less offensive to the Constitution. And so when we're thinking about what the LSO is providing us, just want to make sure everybody recognized the final sentences on the LSO opinion.
Senator Von Plater.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, this looks like a solution searching for a problem. I don't think we've had any issues as far as the microbrewery distributors or their product being distributed. I would like to read that last paragraph of that memorandum you did get received from LSO. It says, the concern I raise here is inherent in the law as it currently stands. However, the bill potentially compounds the issue by providing that not only is the wholesaler required to be a resident, but any owner of any interest in a wholesaler must be a resident. In other words, the bill seems to push the envelope even further. It's not a great bill. I was on that committee. I voted no. I still vote no, and I hope you will too.
Anything further on Senate File 64? Do I hear a question on the bill? Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Peterson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that to do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 64, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No.
No.
Senate File 64 has passed Committee of the Whole.
Division.
Division has been called. All those in favor, please stand. All opposed, please rise. Senate File 64, as the committee chair indicated, has passed Committee of the Whole.
Good ear. Terrible bill, but good ear.
Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Give the staff about 10 minutes stretch, so I'd move that the committee of the whole beg and leave rise to sit again at 3:35.
I think you said that correctly. You've heard the motion. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Motion carries. Committee of the Whole will come back to order.
We don't have a quorum.
Next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 104. The reading clerk will read in the bill.
Senate File 104, Education State Administration. Sponsored by Senator Cole, an act relating to government administration. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Senators Barnard, Cole, Landon, Rothfuss, Senator Cole, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure? Senator Cole.
Move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, do so with due pass recommendation on Senate File 104. Members of the Senate, this is a highly emailed, highly talked about bill. You will hear today from four of us in this body that served on the Select Committee on Accountability. And before I make my opening statement, I'd like to deal with the constitutional question that you've all had on your emails. And if you'll pull this out, this was distributed. This is a copy out of the Washakie decision. Now, for those that don't know what the Washakie decision was, it was in about 1980. It was a decision handed down by the Supreme Court on a challenge of local assessed valuation. We had a lot of districts at that time that had very high assessed valuations and some that had very low assessed valuations. My particular district in Park County at that time had the highest valuation in the state because of oil production. So I'm going to just read part of this decision. Going to Section 1, Article 7, Wyoming Constitution, the general supervision of the public schools shall be entrusted to the state superintendent of public instruction, whose powers and duties shall be prescribed by law. Very clear. Legislature. Section 14, Article 7, Wyoming Constitution. These and other constitutional expressions should leave no doubt that the legislature has complete control of the state school system in every respect, including division of the state into school districts and providing for their financing.
Senator, sorry to interrupt, but would you please pull your microphone up just a little bit higher? Thank you.
Yeah, I'm tall. Thank you. You know, I need to have it up there.
Thank you, Senator.
Sort of like you, Mr. Chairman.
You have to cut the tops of your boots off, too?
Mr. Chairman, I have some opening remarks that I'd like to make, and then I'm going to defer to the good senator from Albany County. Oversight of education is the charge of the Wyoming legislature. 30 years of litigation and Supreme Court cases have made it clear it is the legislature's duty and charge to oversee education. It is our constitutional obligation to ensure the children of our state receive a first-rate education that is second to none. Over the course of the last several years, it has become clear that the current governance structure for education, simply put, does not work. It creates an unstable environment for the people and employees working for our state on educational matters. It creates confusion and a lack of direction for our schools across the state, and the bottom line is, it doesn't produce the results that we need to ensure Wyoming's children are competitive academically, nationally, and arguably globally. The state of Wyoming and the legislature's investment in education is unsurpassed. Annually, we spend $1.4 billion to fund the operation of schools in our great state. Capital construction for schools is growing each year. Today, we have appropriated approximately $1.2 billion for the construction and remodeling of Wyoming schools. It is time for a return on this great investment. Test scores indicate little to no improvement. Graduation rates continue to decline while dropouts increase. Approximately 30% of our college freshmen require remedial classes upon entry. This is unacceptable. We have come too far and invested too much. Our state deserves the best educational system we can create. There is an inherent tension as a result of the current statutory structure governing education. It simply does not allow for clear and consistent direction on educational policy. This tension was recognized as early as 1985 in a management audit study conducted at the direction of the Wyoming legislature and again in 2006. An objective review of the delegation of duties related to education is necessary. Education is growing ever more complex and technical with each passing day. Stabilization and clear direction are imperative to the improvement of education. Senate File 104 provides the structure necessary to ensure the children of our state receive a top-notch education. It will ensure that the laws as passed by this body and the future Wyoming legislatures are carried out in a thoughtful and deliberate manner. It will ensure a stable environment for the people that have dedicated their lives to the work of the state of Wyoming in education. And most importantly, it will provide the public and educational community with the necessary support to improve the education of our children. With that, Mr. Chairman, you all received this big binder today. If you'll take the first five pages of it, that pretty much sums up what each one of the tabs has in it. I think it's worthwhile, at least if you can, to go through those tabs. You'll also see a handout that I distributed. This breaks down what the bill does, what the duties of the superintendent will be, what the duties of the proposed new director will be. And lastly, as a handout, state education governance models, this gives you an idea of what the country's doing. Wyoming is only one of 10 states that still elects their superintendent. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll defer to the good senator from Albany County.
Thank you, Senator Cole. Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I'm going to run through the bill. You have a lot of information, obviously, that provides background and support, but take this opportunity to run through it. Mr. Chairman, there is some important information on page 2, which goes to how a future director would be appointed. And what it indicates is that through this piece of legislation, the governor shall appoint a person as the director of the State Department of Education from a list of 3 names of qualified candidates selected and submitted by the Board of Education. That individual shall serve at the pleasure of the governor and may be removed by him as provided below. In addition, it provides that the appointment shall be Senate confirmed, as you see on lines 11 and 12. But the key to this piece of legislation is basically summarized in lines 14 through 16, which indicates that this new director shall serve as the administrative head and chief executive officer of the State Department of Education. Basically, many of the current statutory responsibilities that are under the Superintendent of Public Instruction would be given to this particular director, and you can see that in detail on this handout that the good senator from Park County showed everyone with the green and yellow, which basically describes the state of things now and the state of things as they would be after this piece of legislation. Moving forward through the legislation, through 104, you've got some substitutions of language on page 3 and 4, and then on page 5, lines 18 through 22, is a discussion that the duties of the director, and the director shall serve as the chief administrative officer of the department, as we previously discussed. Moving forward through to page 6 is a delineation of the requirements of the general supervision of public schools and those entrusted to the state superintendent. Now, there's some amendments to the language on lines 13 through 16, which indicate that there's a change, obviously, that the administrative head and chief executive officer is lined out on lines 14 through 16 because that's moving over to the director. And then, as you can see on line 16 and moving forward, is the enumeration of those responsibilities which would remain under the supervision of the state superintendent of public instruction. And this enumeration includes, as you can see in line 18, an important point that not later than the October 15th each year, the state superintendent shall prepare a report on the general status of all public schools for the legislature. This provision basically provides continued oversight on behalf of the state superintendent of public instruction and makes sure that the state of the education system is looked over by the state superintendent and considered. Those responsibilities go on page 7 and are further enumerated, including on lines 7 through 13, adopting rules and regulations consistent with the title of this article, as may be necessary for proper and effective supervision. On lines 15 through 19, implementation of the Teacher of the Year program. On lines 21 through continuing on to the next page, seclusion and restraint program. And then on line 8, or page 8, lines 10 through 15, concussion and other head injuries program remain under the supervision of the State Director of Public Instruction. From page 8, moving quite a number of pages, and we'll go through to where there's an exception, it's basically a search and replace, so we don't have to go through the entirety of the bill. It is changing where there is in statute right now reference to the state superintendent for a given responsibility to a new assignment of responsibility to the director of the State Department. Paging through 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, search and replace, continuing. And that continues on until page 25, where there's a substantive change. On page 25, lines 16 through 18, there is a provision whereby there is created a State Board of Education, and that number is changed from 12 voting members to 13 members, so an increase in the number of members, while only 11 of them will be voting. The director of the Department of Education, the new director, as well as the state superintendent, would both be ex officio non-voting members of the board at that point. Moving on, there's continued search and replace and a reassignment of responsibilities as we move through the bill. And again, I'll reiterate, all of those reassignments are better summarized on the sheet that the good senator from Park County described in the green and yellow columns, and you can see line by line what is going on with the reassignment of responsibilities. But that takes us to page 61. All of that is, again, a search and replace up until that point. Page 61, on lines 11 through 13, you have some repealers. First repealer is simply removing the right to employ legal counsel from the state superintendent as per current legislation. And then the remaining three repealers, the Romanet 32, 33, and the 21-22-103, are respectively seclusion and restraint, which we moved. So it's not a removal of policy, but it's an explicit assignment of that policy from where it is in statute to under the superintendent of public instruction. 33 is the concussions and head injury legislation, which is, again, just moved to another part of the statute. And the 21-22-103 is actually simply cleanup language from some archaic laws referring to 1992. Moving on to Section 4, Section 4 is expressing some intent, some legislative intent, to make sure that this transfer would move smoothly. As you can see on lines 19 through 24, you have a discussion of the intent being the transfer of all divisions, agencies, programs, positions, personnel, property, and appropriated funds of the Department of Education shall transfer immediately to the interim director of the Department of Education as appointed by the governor as required by this act. So that's the core of the act. That's the intent of the act. Moving on to page 62. Romanet 2 is a transfer of contracts and legal obligations from the superintendent to the director as necessary. Romanet 3 is the transfer of relevant policies, basically saying that the policies that are currently in place within the department remain in effect until otherwise acted upon. So all three of these Romanets are effectively continuity of current policy and obligations between one entity and the other as the transfer is carried out. Section 5 discusses the direct pathway for the governor to declare immediately an interim director after this piece of legislation is passed. And then, as you can see on line 21 of page 62, not later than December 1st, 2013, the governor shall appoint a director. Moving on to page 63, little b enumerates that the interim director shall make the immediate transfer, and moving forward discusses the fact that it's required to report time to time to the Joint Education Interim Committee about the status of the transfer. Little c discusses the separation of the budget, which is a difficult challenge because some of the responsibilities obviously remain with the superintendent, some move to the director, and there's going to be a necessary consideration of what budgets and FTEs remain in which office or move to the new office. That's handled under c. It requires a review of all of the positions by the Department of Administration and Information, and then a presentation to the Joint Appropriations Interim Committee regarding the positions and where they should remain, as well as the funding and the transfers. Moving on to page 64, little d further discusses that the Joint Appropriations Interim Committee shall review those lists of personnel changes and effectuate the changes as required by the Act, provide necessary legislation to do so. Bottom of page 64, little e, discusses that not later than December 1st, 2013, the interim director of the Department of Education shall prepare a status report discussing the entirety of the transfer and presenting it to the Governor, Joint Education Interim Committee, Joint Appropriations Interim Committee, as well as the Select Committee on Statewide Education Accountability, and, of course, the public. And then finally, at the bottom of page 65, little f is an appropriation in this piece of legislation, which we'll deal with in a few minutes with the Standing Committee Amendment. As written, the appropriation is $500,000 to the Governor's office to ease the transition, as well as one additional full-time position, which you can see on lines 21 and 22. That's the summary of the bill. Oh, excuse me, there's page 66. I'm sorry. I thought I was done. Page 66, lines 1 through 8 discuss the separation of the two budgets moving forward. It begins with a continuity of budget items through June 30th, 2014 within the Superintendent of Public Instruction's office, and that funding shall continue. And then it requests, after that point, a separate budget line item. On lines 10 through 13 is just an indication that there's nothing in this act which would limit the authority of the Governor to effect voluntary transfers and positions between agencies as otherwise authorized by law, so there's no preclusion of standard actions from taking place on behalf of the Governor. And finally, lines 15 through 18 is the enacting that this act is effective immediately upon completion of all acts necessary for a bill to become a law. And that is the bill. I believe I'm yielding the floor at this point, if I'm not mistaken, to my colleague across town, the good senator.
Thank you, Senator Raffas. Senator Nicholas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, it's important to begin to talk about what the bill does not do. This bill does not affect the constitutional powers or duty of the state superintendent. As time has developed over the year, or over time, we have created a series of statutory requirements that are legislatively directed, that are well beyond what the founders of our Constitution at the beginning of statehood had in mind. This bill keeps all of the constitutional powers with the state superintendent of public instruction. What we're talking about now is the implementation of legislative policies that we implement through two vehicles. One vehicle is essentially the statutory structure that we implement. The other is the budget that you adopt. When you begin to look at your Constitution, if you look at Article 2, Section 1, one of the most important things to remember is the legislative, executive, and judicial we divide our government into three departments, is what they're called. That's the legislative, executive, and judicial, and no person or collection of persons charged with the exercise of powers properly belonging to one of these departments shall exercise any powers properly belonging either to the others, except as in this Constitution expressly directed or permitted. So we have a Constitution that says there are three departments, and you have distinct different roles to be played. In general, the legislature adopts the policies. We set the policies for the state, and we implement the policies through the budget bill. Executive departments are required to implement our policies, however detailed we determine that they should be. If you turn over then to Section 34 of Article 3, you see a reiteration that the general appropriation bill is to embrace nothing but appropriations and to provide for public schools. Once again, the budget becomes a defining document which we define our policies. Finally, if you turn over to Article 7, Section 1, it begins with the legislature to provide for public schools. The legislature shall provide for the establishment and maintenance of a complete and uniform system of public instruction, embracing free elementary schools of every kind and grade, a university with such technical and professional departments as the public good may require,
and the means of the state allow, and such other institutions of issue necessary. The chairman of education quoted the Washakie decision, which really begins to define it, but what he didn't read was the last sentence of that same quotation. It says, the legislature's powers are subject only to restrictions on discrimination on account of sex, race, or color. Now, in since Campbell 1, beginning Campbell 1, Campbell 2, Campbell 3, the Wyoming Supreme Court said that we have a much larger role to play in the operations of schools. It's a long decision. One of the interesting quotes that goes down in history is that we're required, the legislature is required to fund them and to fund the best possible schools that it can imagine. So not only do we fund them, but we have to chart the path to which we're going to get that benefit, because the Supreme Court says your duty is not simply to fund it, but you have to reach a level of instruction and compliance with your policy to make sure you reach it. And if you haven't reached a particular goal, then you change. Now, over the course of history, the roles of the state superintendent, the state board of education, and at one time the commissioner of education, and the legislature have been often debated. And before Campbell County 1, if you look at your tab D, I don't expect you all to read it now. I've spent the weekend reading those. There's two sets of management audits, one before Campbell 1 and one after Campbell 1. There's the 1985 management audit that you'll read, and then there's the 2005 management audit, which comes after the Campbell County lawsuit. When you begin to read those, they define principally the conflicts that exist between the State Board of Education and the state superintendent. But the thread through all of this is whatever that demarcation is, the responsibility starts and ends with the legislature to define their respective roles to ultimately to implement what we believe are the requirements for obtaining or to making sure that we reach the best possible education that we can conceive of. The second 2005 management audit refers to the 1988 Joint Legislative Committee, and it's called the Executive. It's the Joint Legislative and Executive Study Committee on Government Reorganization. This was the process that led to our current system of government with the leadership that's provided by the governor with a series of directors. And that these directors are, we narrowed the number of agencies and provided cabinet-level positions. And they refer to that, particularly a 1989 study of governmental efficiency, which we've handed out today, which you should have read or should have in the materials that handed out. And in 1988 to 1999, the Joint Legislative Executive Study Commission, in a document called A Study of Government Efficiency, concluded, and there are three pages with a proposed governance style, but I point out under the Superintendent of Public Instruction, the committee believes significant advantages can be gained by restructuring, merging elementary and secondary education, community college, WICHE, and the University of Wyoming into a cabinet-level department, the director of which reports directly to the governor. And if you go over on the following page, it recommends actually the elimination of the position or the constitutional position, which is the state superintendent of public instruction. We're not proposing that in this bill. We're simply saying that the framers of our Constitution had something specifically in mind, and these roles outline that position. Now, over the course of the last 2 years, the need for a reorganization has become particularly evident by the Appropriations Committee. And I mention that because over the years I've counseled all of you advocated to all of you that the single most important document that you adopt each year is, in fact, your budget. And the role of the Joint Appropriations Committee is, in part, to not only prepare the budget, but once you've adopted it, to oversee and watch to see whether or not your budgets are being complied with, whether the executive agencies are, in fact, implementing your budget. Because otherwise, there's really no, absolutely zero benefit to a budget. Otherwise, we'd be giving people block grants and saying, here's the money, and you go forward. Over the course of the last 2 years, or year and a half, we've learned that there's a great deal of disagreement between the roles of the legislature and the state superintendent. And I submit to you the agreement continues today and is reflected in the address to the 62nd legislature and the people of the state of Wyoming. And the point that I would principally point out to is a point on page 12 of that address, which concludes as this, and this is the theme throughout the entire document. It says each branch, the legislature and the state superintendent, the legislative branch, must respect the role and functions of the others. We agree. The Constitution does state that. But it goes on to say it is appropriate for the legislature to set the broad goals that we achieve as a state. For example, the legislature might establish the goal that Wyoming will have the highest graduation rate in the county in 5 years. Or, in a span of 5 years, Wyoming will lead the nation in reading, math, and science scores as measured by NAEP. So the fundamental premise of this entire document is that defines your role. We should simply have a general statement of guidelines with our intended goals. And beyond that, we have no role. When you look at the Constitution, when you look at the section cited to you, it is clear that that is not the scope of our role. Our role is much deeper. When you begin to look at the other statements, what you see is a series of criticisms of the legislative policies adopted. So you look at page 6 in the comments, you see that current reform efforts in Wyoming, I'm going to jump, are essentially out of line, that the legislature has too many things going on, too many people looking at these issues. Over on page 7, item 5, reduction distractions, excessive bureaucracy, inconsistent messages, those are from us, by the way. Multiple non-classroom initiatives and time and energy-consuming activities. These are things that the legislature has implemented that we're being criticized for. You turn to page 10. The accountability that works allows for the freedom to focus on the child, not on the compliance-based model that is inherently bureaucratic, demands that teachers and administrators become box checkers, and requires them to run around assuring others that they are complying. In other words, the proposition is that we should simply say, teachers, go out and do well. And if you do that, there's no accountability. We know things will do well. Folks, since at least Campbell won, we've said that's not good enough. And we've implemented a bunch of procedures. When you look at page 11, you see a criticism of all of the programs that we've implemented over time, including PAWS, SAWS, the ACT, ACT, and the testing. Things that were debated on this floor, on both floors. You have essentially a statement of belligerence that said, look, we think the legislative has got it wrong, and what we think that is important are principles that we believe are more important than the legislature. And we see that in a couple areas. During the legislative session last year, we discovered that the or during the budget hearings, we discovered that a new program called Teacher to Teacher had been commenced without any consultation with the Joint Education Committee. The first time we discovered it really, well, we discussed it before, but we learned the details of the first time in the Joint Appropriations Committee. And this was an entirely new program, never brought to the legislature, funded entirely by going to budgets that we established for other programs, raiding the funds out of those programs and putting them into a new program. Now, we told our position was on the JAC is if you want Joint Appropriations Committee, if as the superintendent you choose to implement these programs, fair enough. If you want the program, go before the Joint Education Committee, outline your program, advocate for it, and if the legislature agrees, they'll implement it. In this instance, you'll recall that during last year, the legislature said, the JAC, the Joint Appropriations Committee, said we'll allow funding for one-year operation, but do take it in front of JEC, the Joint Education Committee, and bring it back through a budget process, through the proper process. Also during this would be 2011 going to 2012, we said there was a concern about position realignments and whether they were properly aligned. We had positions being moved from one expense code to another without going through the proper budgetary analysis. And we said, look, bring back your present alignments. We'll give you a free pass. Just tell us what you're going to do. And there was a series of budget alignments, I want to say 6 to 10 positions that were aligned during that position. The Joint Appropriations Committee believed that the problem had been resolved. You'll recall that then we went into the session and that a bill for accountability had come through. And for the first time that at least we were aware of it, the Joint Appropriation Committee, actually to be the Senate Appropriations, a fiscal note was presented to the JAC that had not been provided to the JEC, saying that the implementation of the bill that had been an interim bill, worked on for almost a year, would have a fiscal impact of, $11 million, which was not in our budget. That created a great enough concern that we said, look, is our staff to simply disagree that the cost of that bill had that type of impact. So he said, before we fund any new programs, we're going to collect all the money for accountability, put it into a specific account to be spent only for accountability, no other purpose. And we knew that there were funds that had been already spent out of those accounts for other purposes, but ultimately those funds were found back into the account and we're now spending them there. And in the budget, this legislature, this body said, we are not going to authorize nor allow the expenditure of the teacher-to-teacher program. No funds will be permitted for that program. So this year, when we return, we find out that the teacher-to-teacher program has been renamed to the SLIT program, Special Literacy Program, Education Program. When you go look at the materials, it's the same exact materials in general that was the teacher-to-teacher. It's the same program. The testimony was, well, the legislature implements programming, but this is initiative, and we're entitled to do our own initiatives within the department, and we're free to go to various budgets and pull the money out. In this case, the principal source of those funds were special education funds being used to develop what was the converted teacher-to-teacher to the SLIT program. We also then see that there are also a B-11 process was initiated. B-11 is a process where when you, when we're absent, we have a process called a B-11 form. The B-11 form is available for agencies to make corrections. If there's federal dollars coming in, we don't have to bring the legislature back in. Rather, the agency can go to the governor
and ask for authorization to pull down federal funds, and there's an authorization in this case to move positions. We directed that no positions be made, no changes within our expense codes be made within the Department of Ed, except that the B-11 process is complied with. A B-11 was requested to move a large number, almost 30 positions, around within the department. The governor said, I'm not prepared to approve this. I want to understand this better, and actually requested the Department of Audit to assist him in evaluating it. What we know what happened then is that we also have a mechanism to get into budgets where agencies can go into the state auditor's budget and using what's called a general expense modification, you can make changes to certain codes or things that were already done. So if you went in and you prepared an invoice or actually in this case a requisition or a payment and there was a mistake in it, you could go out and use the general expense modification, the acronym is GEMS, to move the money. What we see is the GEMS process was used in this instance to move the entire 30 positions out, going around the budget or the B-11, and we're instructed by our staff that many of the accounts from which those funds were withdrawn to move those positions are likely to fall short of the appropriation needed to carry through the legislative appropriation. Folks, what's important here is that every one of the accounts that we set up, every expense code, was established by the legislature. So you as a legislator, if you want to implement a program, then you fight for the program. You achieve the approval of your colleagues, and then an expense organization is created to implement that program. So no dollar ever arrived in anybody's budget except that the legislature, as a whole, approved of those budgets. And it's our expectation, then, that unless you use a allowed process, every dollar in the budget will be spent as approved. And more than that, it's our expectation that the programs that we establish legislatively will be implemented and be implemented by the legislative budgets that we adopt. And in this instance, we simply know that that's not taking place. Now I can go on. I also handed out today a memo on January 3rd, 2012 from our budget staff that has a series of attachments that show where the funds for the split program are coming from and the various expense codes, showing the nature of that program that provides for payments directly to teachers to teach, teachers to show up on a Saturday. Some teachers have gone to it multiple times. There's a lot of issues, all of which this is a program that simply should have been started first by legislative approval. You've also heard there's this interest in the usage of the jet, state jet, and not only the use of the state jet, but what accounts was that a utilization charged. My recollection is about $50,000 worth of jet time, 129 legs, and an allocation among various accounts, including special education. So, folks, in the end, as we move through this process, we are not changing any constitutional duty assigned to the superintendent. We have established a number of statutory programs that we've initiated since Campbell 1. And we appropriate both federal and state dollars. Remember this, too, is that unless you use the B-11 process, federal dollars are authorized to be pulled down for the purposes for which we authorize. So when you look in your budget, you'll see that there are federal funds appropriations. No agency can walk to the federal government and say, I see you have money that's free money and we'd like to have it. You either have to have the legislature appropriate the authorization to get the money and spend it, or you have to go to the governor if we're not in session to go have the governor implement a B-11 process with the governor, then authorizes the dollars to be pulled down. And in this instance, what we see is that we simply have a fundamental disagreement with this statement that says, for example, the legislature might establish the goal that Wyoming will have a highest graduation rate in the county and country in 5 years, or in a span of 5 years, Wyoming will lead the nation in reading, math, science scores as measured by NAEP. If you believe that that's all your authority is, and you fundamentally agree with that, then you can go on business as usual. Of course, we don't need to be debating all these statutes. We can simply give a block grant to say, here's the block grant. Come back in 5 years and tell us whether or not you've met our goals. Or, if you want to implement the programs, we're simply seeing a continuing manifestation of the issues that were addressed in the 1985 management audit, reconfirmed in 2006 or 2005, and this is simply the commencement of something that was recognized in what we all called the Ferrari Report years ago that recommended the reorganization of government. I urge your support of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Majority Floor Leader. Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I do agree with a lot of the things that have been said here on the floor today. However, I think we're premature to move this bill forward in the state that it's in. And let's go to the constitutional question. Perhaps in the letter of the Constitution, we could find quite a little bit support for the argument that's been made. But I think in the actual spirit of the Constitution, I think it may fall a little bit short. Because there's another part of the Constitution that basically says we've elected these folks for 4 years and they're to serve in that capacity. Granted that we have the capacity to change those duties, and we do that every year that we meet down here. However, if you just look at it on the face of it, this bill essentially replaces almost all of the duties of the superintendent of public instruction, leaves her with a couple of things there, like the Teacher of the Year award. So, you know, it's on the face of it, yeah, you could say technically we haven't maybe crossed that line, but in the spirit of violating the Constitution, I think the bill absolutely does, because essentially we fired the superintendent of public instruction moving this bill forward. With the effective date that we have on it. You know, I just don't believe in the spirit of the Constitution that there's any argument about that, and everybody knows that. Mr. Chairman, there's some questions that I'd have here I'd go through on the teacher program or the split program or however you want to do that. Basically, it's a difference between a program versus outreach methodology. Now, the State Department of Education is charged with going out and trying to move our goals and their goals out to the districts. And a little history of this is like about 35 or 40 years ago, they'd give funds to the districts and the superintendents would go on a junket to San Francisco or Dallas or someplace, and the gurus of education would tell them how to teach kids, and they'd come back and they'd disseminate that information. And then it kind of moved to where they'd have some head teachers or some team leaders at the schools go with them on these junkets, and they'd come back, and then they'd get a little extra money to disseminate that information. And then, Mr. Chairman, it kind of progressed from there where the gurus would come into the school districts and they would teach some of the folks that wanted to disseminate that information, and they'd have small groups of teachers and the curriculum directors and the superintendents and principals get educated in that, and then they disseminate that information to the rest of the teachers. And then it's moved to the next step, Mr. Chairman, where the gurus would come in and they would take that information, and anybody that was really wanted to know what was going on, they'd each get paid maybe $100 or $150 a day to sit in the auditorium and they'd disseminate that information. Well, the teacher-to-teacher or the split program does it pretty much as a progression to the next step, which is a lot cheaper than any of the ones previous to that, is to get some folks from the Department of Education and get with teachers that want to be essentially team leaders in the schools, and they allow some continuing education credits, and they can meet on a Friday or a Saturday. They've got great participation. That might cost about $45,000 or $50,000 a year to go around the state versus, you know, whatever it was for the airplane tickets to San Francisco and Dallas and things. And specifically, I understand that is because my wife's been a school teacher for 36 years, and I kind of lived with the progression about how information was disseminated. So that's the teacher-to-teacher or the split program. Looking into the B-11 process and what was going on in that situation over the course of the year, there's been an extreme amount of turnover in that department. Now, part of that, I think, was probably the management style of the superintendent or whatever was going on. There's been some situations over there where there's been a great deal of turnover. A lot of the positions had to be realigned with the particular expertise of the people that were in the department. Different duties had to be combined. Different people had to do more things than they were doing. And that was really the reason for the B-11s that were necessary. And, Mr. Chairman, going on down to a couple of other things that I see in the bill, that currently we've got a lot on the plate of the superintendent of public instruction. And we all know that. It's a big job. And I'm not saying that this isn't a direction that eventually we should go, is to get some expertise in areas that and some different organizational structure. But the way this bill does it is it essentially makes the governor have a dual role. He's basically the governor, and he's acting almost in the exact same role as our current superintendent of public instruction. So now you have the governor being able to essentially hire and fire the director, which is exactly what the superintendent of public instruction does as far as hiring and firing the people that are just directly under her, which do the work and the everyday workload, you know, of the Department of Education. So I'm really concerned about the power that we're putting into the executive branch of the governor. And I think that extends past just the day-to-day work of what's going on basically in the Department of Education. It extends into politics. And the politics is that when you have a situation where you have a governor that's running for governor, and that's a big job, a lot on that plate, but now he's got all the education on his plate also. And so you get into a political situation where you may get a person who's running for governor pretty good in education, and that's important to the people in Wyoming, but he might not have the skills that a governor needs to have. And so I think we're putting too much workload on that executive branch. Now, there's other ways that other states do it, and I think we need to explore those. And these are ways where either a state elected board appoints the director, or whether there's and then they're hired and fired by the board. And that isolates the governor from the situation. So there's that aspect that I think we have to look at in this. And I think I go back to looking at the way the bill is directed, where everything is switched over from the superintendent practically to the director. And some of them don't really deal with education. There's one in here, and I'm not sure what it is. It's something called the State Committee. And it's over on page 42, the bottom of 42, top of 43. And this has to do with district boundaries. And it says the State Committee shall. And I'm trying to find out what State Committee that is. I think it's a State Committee on boundaries in district organization. But there we're making that change, and I'm not sure how that effect is going to be. There's over on page 40, you've got the state director doing the transportation and maintenance of isolated pupils. That's something that expressly has to do with education, and I think that perhaps that could be taken off the plate and put on the superintendent's plate. And if you look back on the charter school program, necessarily the state superintendent could probably do that because that doesn't deal with the day-to-day activities of education, as well as going back into and that's 37 and 38 on the charter school. There's some other places over on page 32, 33, and this is the State Board of Education that perhaps we could allow the Teacher Standard Board on 32 and 33, allow the superintendent to do that and not have the director as involved in that. Try to split those duties apart to where the director is dealing with the foundation program, the federal programs, delivering education to the students. And those are the things that we're really concerned about, because education is that time between the student and the teacher. And our job, and I think the superintendent's job, is try to make that time as quality and as effective in that process as we can in education, because that's where the rubber really meets the road. And in the state board, I think the superintendent could probably have a voting member on that, and not necessarily the director would have to be that involved. But you can go through a lot of places in here. I named a few of them that I think we need to really take a look at to see when we organize this as to whether or not just exactly what we want to do. Now let's talk a little bit about the director. No place in here do we have the qualifications of this person. No place are there qualifications. Where other states that have done this have said that we need qualifications. They have to have a master's in public administration or education degree or different things, 5 or 10 years experience in different disciplines. So, you know, there's a lot of things that we need to look at so we can make sure that a director has the ability to handle a job. And other states have gone through this and they've done that. Now, this bill is a good start to trying to make that determination. But, folks, I don't think we can move this thing ahead today and run it through the process with three readings and another some more committee work and get exactly what we need out of it so we can move forward. You know, I'm not saying that it's not a good idea, but I'm saying is that we have all this information, all of this whole booklet that we've been supplied, and nobody knows what's in it, really. So we've got a lot of work to do if we're going to do this right. We shouldn't make a snap judgment on it. And on the last thing, we haven't had the budget appropriations amendment written in yet, which we'll talk to. But when we come to that point, I think we need to have some further discussion about that, because we haven't figured out what we're going to pay this person. It's not there. It's all up in the air. We haven't really done a good study to find out what we should pay the person. Nobody knows. We couldn't make that determination. We heard that there was some surveys out there that might become forthcoming. We basically stripped the appropriation out and put it back in the hands of the governor. You know, it's, guys, this is a good attempt, but it's not ready for prime time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cole.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me give you a little history here. The thing that hasn't been talked about so far today is what we put in law. In 2011, it was Senate File 70. In 2012, it was Senate File 57. When we were involved in the recalibration process in 2010, we realized that we spend as much or more than anybody in the country for 48 school districts and 89,000 kids. So our focus shifted from adjustments in the model to accountability. Senate File 57 that we passed last year deals with implementations of assessment, and then in the second part, measuring. That's where we tie student achievement to teacher performance. That was our role. We put that in law. We had enough concern last year about the implementation of that part of it that we created two legislative liaisons. What you see in this big white book and this is a report from the legislative liaisons that have been working for us, the legislature. And it's not pretty. We had to pass 11 amendments in July in Torrington to correct the focus of the department. It was a fiasco. The lack of cooperation, the lack of recognizing what's in law, what's in statute, has not been there from the department. There's been roadblock after roadblock thrown in front of us. In our December meeting here in Cheyenne, we had to put delays in because things had not gotten done. For example, the accountability model that was due in October of 2012, we had to move that to June of 2013. The discussion we're having here on this floor today has to do with what this legislature passed. Accountability. We believe strongly in it. We spend $1.4 billion a year in schools, and the results are just not where we want them to be. You heard the good senator from Goshen County talk about the director and how the governor's going to come in and the governor's going to appoint that person. This bill doesn't provide for that. The State Board of Education comes up with three names, and we've got those people on the State Board of Education because we think they have the expertise to know what needs to happen. They submit three names to the governor. Then the governor chooses one. And the last time I checked, the governor was a statewide elected official as well, just like the superintendent. So this is a good bill. This has to happen now, or accountability will go away. We just can't continue down the path we're going today. This is what has to happen to help us move down that path on education accountability. I ask that you support the bill.
Senator Schiffer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I do have a question, and I'm focusing on page 6 on subparagraph B, that the state superintendent shall prepare a report on the general status of schools and so on. Now, I've got a question on that, particularly in light of the fact that the state superintendent is elected statewide. The state superintendent is accountable to all the people in the state, and it's a direct election. Was there any discussion on, and in that position, that provides, that position has a unique ability to step back and say, how are we doing?
from the perspective of the entire population of the state. How are we doing in education? It's a tremendous responsibility, I think. It is one of the few times I've seen where we said somebody is responsive directly to the people to tell us how good a job we're doing. We've never had that before, and I applaud that. But my question is, was there any discussion in terms of the areas of focus for that study? And let me just offer some thoughts that would include an assessment of the quality of the education. How good is it? From a representative of the people, looking at their school systems, what's the quality? What's the improvement? What are the shortfalls? That type of discussion. The relevance of the education. Does it fit what students need today? And I think that would encompass both career-oriented and higher education-oriented students. In other words, that's kind of the two populations we got, is the education that the superintendent's constituents are getting. Is it relevant to what we need? I would think it would include something along the line of the measurement of the achievements of education. Are we making progress from that independent point of view? A third one, are there innovations that we should be putting out? I think that falls under the category of someone, direct voice of the people, saying what are the innovations we have, can use, should be included in that report. My question is, and I'm not an educator. I'm just saying it seems to me that role, one, it's vital to the improvement of education, but two, it is the voice statewide of the consumers of our education system. Do we need to go into more detail and say, all right, what's got to be in there? Was that ever a topic of discussion in the hearings?
Senator Rothfuss.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, addressing those last comments first, I think that's an excellent list of potential topics, and we didn't discuss the specifics of what would go into that report, but I think that's a great starting point on what we should include in that list, and I'd look forward to potentially a second reading amendment to add that in to clarify some of those details. It's a great start, and perhaps I'd be happy to work with a good senator on adding additional content as well as the chairman. Appreciate that thought. We've heard some discussion about the concept of how long we should wait and when we should start this and whether or not the bill's ready for prime time. The good chairman discussed the difficulties that we've had over the last couple of years and the delays we've already put in place. The reality is we're at least a year behind at this point in time. And it's not a simple matter of policy. It's a matter of all of the people that are being affected by the system. We want to get this done as quickly as we possibly can. We want to be affecting the children that are in the system right now and putting together a positive resource for them, resource for their schools, resource for their teachers as soon as possible. That's the reason why over the last couple of years, the Select Education Accountability Committee and the Technical Advisory Committee has met for over 30 days. It's been a very active committee trying to get things done, trying to come up with solutions. Along the way, regrettably, we have been trying to work, but we've met resistance. The recommendations, the policy choices, the decisions that we've made and tried to put forward, the framework that we tried to implement, the model that we tried to implement, each of these met with resistance. Trying to change the ACT as the 11th grade, to become the 11th grade accepted NCLB test, again, it met with resistance. We potentially may suffer a fine as a result of that. All of these difficulties, all of this delay needs to end. And I realize you can always craft a bill better. We could always come back next year and take another look, and we could come back the following year and have another good look at that bill. But what we have to recognize, Mr. Chairman, is that we have children running through the system right now. We are in a hurry to try and put something good out into practice. It can be improved upon potentially in the future, but we want to make sure that we're affecting as many kids as soon as possible as we can. And while I recognize that there may be some amendments that need to go forward, and I appreciate the constructive comments that my colleagues here have provided today, but I would certainly encourage that we look to those amendments, look to those suggestions, consider them as we're moving this bill forward rather than delaying further. We've wasted 1 year already, Mr. Chairman, one full year, and I don't want to waste another.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thanks to the Education Committee and work, and I understand the frustrations of serving on appropriations for the last 6 years and have witnessed some of these frustrations. And I just want to echo the sentiment that this has been in no means a personal attack on our current superintendent of public instruction, but rather an attack on the structure that we've had to work over, under, through, you name it. It's been very frustrating for the last 20, 30, 40 years. And so it's the structure. And I've spent the last weekend, as many of you have, in defending our legislative right to address this concern and this issue. But as I read over this bill, there were a couple of things that stood out, and I just had to mention this because I think we're struggling to try to find things for the new superintendent of public instruction if this bill passes, that they'll be over, whoever that superintendent of public instruction is. And then on page 8, lines 10 through 15, it struck me. To assist local school districts in developing protocols under and develop model protocols for addressing risks associated with concussions and other head injuries resulting from athletic injuries. And it gets better. No district shall be required to adopt any part of the model protocols. It kind of reminds me of the job that my dad gave me years ago in our family business of telling the employees that this is my son and he's in charge of this, and then patting me on the back and saying, do a great job. And then excusing me and then telling the employees, whatever he decides, make sure it's passed through me first. And it just doesn't seem right. As a business owner working on a budget all the time, I would hope that if a bill like this passes, that we eliminate this position eventually, because I would not be in favor of paying twice for the services that we're trying to receive from this position. This is a double-headed dragon, and I don't know... besides a salary, why a person would run for this position. I guess that's reason alone. But I have my concerns about this. And again, I don't know how I'm going to vote on this. Probably yes for the first reading or two. But by the third, if some of these things aren't cleaned up and looked at and better described, I don't know if I can pass this. And I know that changes need to be made, and maybe this is the answer. But I have my concerns and reservations right now. And I've spent the last weekend, as many of you have, defending our right as a legislature to try to address these concerns and problems. And I made the point to a lot of my constituents back home that we trust our local school boards to hire and fire and interview our local superintendents, but we don't seem to trust our most highly elected official in the state of Wyoming via the governor and through the selection process through our Board of Education. So it's ironic that our constituents back home are thinking that their constitutional rights are being trampled on by this particular bill. And so I'm confused still, but I do not like trying to come up with a job description for a position, and maybe this is the only way to go about it. But if this bill does pass, I would kind of remind the body to take care of this problem as soon as possible, because as a business manager, we'll try to work with the budget in our private sector. This just wouldn't fly. It just would not fly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dockstetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, none of us are really happy with how this has turned out, are we? But we have an educational system now that's it's suffering and it needs repair. I acknowledge the great work of our committee. They've done incredible work, not just on this, but over the last few years. We need to acknowledge that. But is 104 the only answer to our problem? possibly may be one of the better answers right now based on what we're looking at. But I have been working with those in education at home, both before we came down, and made a quick trip back home this weekend and visited with them again. And I found one overall theme from them, and these are people I listen to because they're doing well in the system, probably just fine without all of our involvement, because they continue to put out students and test results in the top five of all the subjects. Probably have the best readers in the state. They have a school that's got national recognition. And essentially, they're kind of just getting along just fine without a lot of involvement. They're making it happen. But I listened to them, and there was one overall theme that I came back with. And it's essentially, please don't change the entire system because of one situation or one individual. They can make it work. They'll find a way to make it work. So a no vote on this bill is not necessarily a vote of support for the Department of Education, because I can't, not when probably half the department's gone and we got position realignments and programs without legislative approval. That's a major concern. But I have to listen to those who are successful in the programs, and they're saying, be very careful about changing the entire system because of one situation. Thank you.
Senator Nutting, and then we'll go to Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have some very severe concerns about this bill. It creates a real shift of power, and that is that it takes some of the power away from the electors within the state. That means the voters within our state, and shifts that power to the governor. And we're blessed with a great governor, but we don't know what decisions would be made by a future governor. But I wonder also about the shift of power away from the legislature also. It makes this person, this director, then would be closest and work most closely under the governor and have then less accountability to the legislature and more to the governor. I am in favor of retaining that power within the voting members of the state. The Constitution really gives us two measures by which we remove people who don't perform the duties of their office well. The first of those is that they face re-election, and the people can not re-elect them. If something needs to be done quicker, we have the power of impeachment. But we've selected yet a third route, and that is to take the responsibilities away from an elected officer. So I have very severe concerns for the bill in those aspects. And then I wonder about some of our expectations. One of the data that has been quoted here is that our graduation rate has gone down. Well, a graduation rate is affected very slowly. This superintendent has been in office for 2 years. We have an interesting set of statistics across our state in that one of our school districts has two schools with extremely low graduation rates. And some of our schools have extremely high graduation rates, which implies that there are other factors than the system of education, that is, cultural values, of the populations involved, so that to have that a consideration for someone who's been in office for just 2 years seems like not a good measure for us to be looking at.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, for all the years that I've been down here, education has been one of the top priorities of not only this legislature, but the state government as a whole, and I think the people of Wyoming as a whole. And we've done a lot over the years
I came in just in the aftermath of the Washke decision. I actually came in slightly before it. We've been improving our school funding system. We've tried to be more equitable so that we got funding where it was needed. And we've done some things in that area that I think we can be very proud of. I'll cite just one example of the situation with the schools on the reservation up in Fremont County. Those are some of the best funded school districts in the state with our current system. Unlike some other states, they aren't crippled by poor assessed local valuation. We've done a lot to improve the funding for education. That, for years, that is our focus. And we've reached a situation, we've been there for some time, where we have the best funding, one of the best fundings in the country. And we are not seeing the kind of results that we should be seeing, given the length of time that we've been funding the schools as well as we have been. We continue to get better than average, but only somewhat better than average, when we really should expect to be one of the best performances on average in the country. And that's not just a phenomenon of the past 2 years. As was alluded to previously, it's been going on for quite some time. And what this bill does is say to us, enough is enough. We're essentially wasting the lives of a bunch of children who are not getting the kind of education that they should be. And it's time to make a drastic change. I'm sure we can improve the bill. I have some reservations myself about the provision that requires the State Board of Education to provide three nominees. I think we might be better off telling the governor, you find the best person you can and submit that person to Senate confirmation. That might be a better system, a little clearer responsibility. That's a detail. The basics of this bill are that we have gone too long without seeing the kind of performance that we should get out of our public school system. And it's time to make drastic changes to the system, because the system we've got is simply not producing results.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, rising neither in favor nor opposition to the bill, but as my good senator from Natrona County has pointed out, the questions that I have is if this is the problem with education and it's not working, what's the guarantee that this is the solution? Can somebody answer me and tell me that if we pass this and we put a director of education in, that we're going to be first in the nation? Second, third, fourth? Is this a solution to the problem? I don't know. I'm asking the proponents. Is this the solution that's going to guarantee that all these students that we're spending $1.4 billion on is going to solve the problem? Just a question.
Senator Scott.
Chair, serious point, deserves a serious answer. In this kind of human affairs, there can be no guarantee. Things can go wrong. About the only guarantee you have is if we continue the current system, it's going to produce the kind of results we've been getting. And they aren't good enough. We're reaching out to the part that is the state government role and saying, that's the first place we've got to change. It isn't working. It's got to be different. I'm sure there'll need to be fine-tuning of it. I'm sure you will never get perfection, and you can't guarantee results, except that you can guarantee if you don't do things, you can expect the same kind of result.
Let's go to Senator Case.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I like this whole thing. I've been here a long time. I've got to where I can't hear, and I probably smell bad and all that, just sitting on this floor for 20-some years. And I've seen most of the changes in education. We've made those changes. And, you know, I'm not sure that half the fault isn't ours. And I think half the fault is in that building across the street where the people in the big robes sit. Because I'm not sure that was necessarily the way that happened. And we seem to fix the funding problem. But I'm not sure that we've really fixed the education problem. And I'm not sure that's the problem in that building over there, or this building here, Mr. Chairman. Because it seems like every year, the newest trend in education, you throw everything out and you do this, and we have this bill, and the next year we're going to have that bill, and we're going to pile it on and pile it on and pile it on. I'm not really sure that anybody can do anything with that. I know our local school boards are going, whoa. I'm sure that any administrator that we try to hand all this stuff to is also doing the same thing. That all being said, I concur that there's a problem. I just don't exactly know how to fix it. But I know that one way you don't fix things is to try to fix it fast and furious, Mr. Chairman. Now, this bill has some of my most respected friends in the legislature on it as authors of it and co-sponsors. But it's not a committee bill, Mr. Chairman. It seems to have come about kind of at the amalgamation of important people in leadership and that serve in these committees that do understand what they're talking about. I know you do, and I respect it. But it's not a committee bill. It's not an interim committee study that comes up with this recommendation that's thoughtful and included the whole state of Wyoming with hearings for a while to come and say this. And it's, you know, this is an elected position, the superintendent's elected position. The people that really get to decide about that are sitting out there and go to the voting booth and proudly cast their ballot, and they'll get to do that in 2 years. Now, if there's something really rotten and there's grounds for impeachment, we could do that. We could do that in this session. We could do that upon a special session if we were called in by the governor. But I'm not convinced that we should take this step right now based on a bill that's an individual bill, not a committee bill. So I'm not ready to do this.
Senator Anderson, 02.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to make a proposal. And it's going to be a proposal that you can all participate in regard. If you've ever programmed computers, there's a go and a no-go. And this is going to have a go and a no-go in it, so you can determine as a body whether we're going to move forward. I'm just going to say that having spent half my life in a classroom, spent 2 years in that office there, 2 years there, I spent 6 years in leadership, one of the things that I tried to do constantly, as I tried to do this afternoon, is sit and read people. And I sat on the floor and I listened very carefully to all the debate. And I tried to read all the faces. And I can't read them. Now I don't need to read them so that I can go with the flow or I can go with the wind. But the idea being, all the debate on this floor this afternoon indicates kind of the conundrum for this idea of being a rock and a hard place. Well, anyway, within our own code, it says nowhere to draw the line. Seems to me that we're ready to draw the line. But it also says do what has to be done, and we're struggling to determine what must be done. So listen to me for a moment. I don't know how I'm going to vote. Maybe 5 minutes from now, if I don't talk too long, we'll be able to vote, and I'll tell you then. But what I would like to propose, and I think that there's been a group of folks that have not been heard in this conversation. Point was made from the corner a little bit. This thing came pretty rapidly. We have not yet heard from the people. And I've been listening to people on this computer, over 200 emails in the last 2 days. And believe me, I read every one, but I honestly did not answer many. I just not have had the time. But the people out there are beginning to wonder in regard to what's going on. And we're actually beginning to get ourselves into a bit of a stalemate, much like what people see in Washington. It's never happened here before. But it's not a very tasteful place to be. Here's a proposal without talking too long. Now, I'm going to make this proposal on a second reading amendment in the event. Now, here's the go. If we have a very close vote in regard to our first reading, I'll make the proposal. If it fails, there's no need for it. If it's a strong vote and we move this thing forward, probably no need for it. So I will make this proposal on second reading. In the event, it seems to be close and we're still in a bit of a quandary. This proposal is going to be presented to you as a concept today with an invitation for anyone up there, anyone down here to work with me in regard to the construction of the preliminary concept to be used on second reading, perhaps if it moves forward to be improved on third reading. If it passes third reading, continue to be improved upon as it goes through the system. So we have a bit of a better plan to go on. It's not instant. In other words, it's going to take some more time. It's going to engage more people. It's going to engage the public. So here's what I'm suggesting without taking long. It's presented in the spirit of compromise. It would be presented as a second reading amendment. I would make up a impartial panel. Now you call it what you want. Call it blue ribbon. It can be of any size. But it would be an impartial panel paneled of those people outside the two squabbling, so to speak, parties here to look at all the information we presented. It would probably be, the main players would be, of course, the Senate, the Department, and the people of Wyoming. Would be as big as necessary. But it probably would not have any legislators on it because of the bias on one side of the argument, nor would have anybody from the superintendent's office of the department on the other side. It would be fairly large. It would be made from the private sector, and mediation would be the key, would be the objective. It would review the issues, and the issues seem to be revolving around the election issue, the constitutional side, and what's good for Wyoming on the other side, and examine those two sides. But we have to address what I think the public perception is. Now, you can agree whether that's accurate. I've received everything from a very few compliments to quite a few threats. But the public perception out there is, number one, they don't thoroughly understand what we're doing, why we're doing it, and their perception is they have had taken away from them someone who they voted for, regardless of how effective or ineffective that person, but it's a constitutional issue in their minds, and if there's anything probably more important than educational issues, it's a constitutional issue. So that's a bit of the deadlock that needs to be addressed. There's a need for public participation, for transparency. With the idea, if something like this went into play, it would be much like a jury in the sense that we would not be able to present influence and other than just testimony or whatever evidence at their request, but there would be no attempt on our part to influence the outcome, nor would there, should there be any in attempt to influence the outcome from the other side, be it the superintendent or the department, during those deliberations. The idea being that was be engaged by the private sector, public participation, bring recommendations in regard to the finding after careful deliberation, careful examination of the facts, review the research, the literature, points of contention, the constitutionality,
the educational principles that have been put forward in order to render some sort of a compromise so that we can then move forward. And again, like I said, depending on the outcome of this vote about to be made, whether or not I will go forward with that, and the fact that if I would go forward, I'd embrace anybody to come with me, work tomorrow morning, we'll try to put some form to some fashion. Seeking fairness, impartiality, public buy-in, common ownership. So if you agree, pitch in. If you don't, and it goes forward, just simply vote no on the on the amendment proposal. Kick it out. No ownership on my part. It's just an opportunity to put some sort of structure in this so that we can provide for a better process. And if I've learned anything in my experience in the legislature, if the process is right, it will come out right. And I won't sit and criticize, I won't examine, but somehow there's been a flaw in the process here, and that we don't have the knowledge, the buy-in, and the ownership of the people who count most, and that's people out there. This will be then, I think, a process that would be geared to move forward towards a solution. Who should succeed in this? Who should win? I think the children would be the ones who should succeed, and they should win, and it's not whether we win or they win, but it's whether or not the children win. So I'll just simply leave it with that. That's a proposal. We'll know after the vote what the intention is. If the intention is my part to move forward, you can come help me out, put your thoughts to it, and if it looks like that it's an exercise in futility, a fool's errand, fine. If it moves forward and you vote no, that's okay too. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator, thank you. I'd like for that to be the last word. However, we do, Mr. Chairman, have a standing committee amendment that we have to deal with. Would you like to have that read in at this time?
I would move the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senate File 104, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this amendment comes from the re-referral to the joint or to the Senate Appropriations Committee. Members of the Senate, is pretty straightforward what the amendment does, and it's been read in and moved. Page 1, line 7, we delete through position. Page 65, we delete lines 9 through 22. What this essentially does is eliminate and remove the $500,000 appropriation and the position. We heard testimony in the Senate Appropriations Committee from both the prime sponsor of the bill and the chairman of the joint or the Senate Education Committee, as well as out of the governor's office, that there are funds available within the department's budget to take care of this. We didn't see there was any need to have it, so we removed it. I would ask for your support.
Any questions on the standing committee amendment? Question having been called. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt standing committee amendment number 1 to Senate File 104, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, no. The standing committee amendment has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Nicholas.
Mr. Chairman, I think we work on all amendments, and I think we take every approach we need to work this process through. When I hear some of the comments being made, I think it's important to recognize a couple features, and that is, you know, I don't think I'm much different than many of the rest of you. When I began 16 years ago, the issue of my campaign was education. And it was of great importance to my constituents. It's been the front and foremost issue in every election that I've run in the last 16 years. I ran on account of Campbell 1, the opportunity to get statewide equalization funding and move forward. Like my colleague to the right,
My wife is in education and been teaching all those years. And I've seen a huge change in the population, the students that she teaches. I've seen kids, or just had kids describe to me that whose parents don't make them do homework, don't get them to school on time, they come unfed, and the growing number of kids with functional disabilities is increasing, and the disabilities, abuse, things like that are just almost hard to believe. And we're not talking just a few days. And so when we began to talk about a system of education and whether it's working or not, or whether or not we've implemented it or not, that's a journey that we're going to take, and it's going to require a lot of time. We didn't have the fix, but let's take one example. We've been debating since Campbell won, whether or not K through 3 should have 16 students per class. Whether that's what we're funding and that's the number of students that should be there, no exceptions. Actually, the House on that first bill passed a requirement that all schools, no classroom will have more than 16. And if you have your bus students, you'll do whatever it takes to distribute students so there's 16 to 1. The Senate rejected that amendment, and we've talked about it ever since. But what we need and what we've always needed is a mechanism for us to be here for 3 months, adopt policies, request accountability programs, and get data so that we can go out and measure what's the difference between those classrooms that are having 16 to 1 or the ones that have 22 to 1 and a paraprofessional of some sort or an aide. Are they really performing well? Should we provide local support in those areas? And what we're seeing in the time since that we began, in my case, 16 years ago to forward, fast forwarding, was a massive effort to get more accountability and data collection so that when you make a change, you can come back a year later and start to begin to see what's happening. I can tell you that for my children, my youngest children absolutely got better education in some of the core areas my younger children than the older, because we implemented state standards, and frankly, the teachers started making a greater concentration in writing and arithmetic and some of those areas that I frankly think that my younger children improved. And that was on account of initiatives that came here. The difficulty we're having is that when we fund these programs and say this is the information we want and we don't get it back, there's no way for us to respond. And the difficulty I have in saying let's go out and study it one more year, you've got two management audits, you had the Ferrari report, and here we are last year at this time. We said, look, our most important functions are the functions that we put in the budget. Let's get those done. When an agency goes out and said, well, we have a different idea of what's important and those things aren't as important, we come back a year without that information, without the tools that we need to know whether or not we're doing the programs right, whether we're moving forward, or whether we're getting the change quickly enough. But at the end of the day, all of us were elected, all 90 of us were elected to adopt policies, and we have an obligation and right to our constituencies to say, these are the programs. This notion that, well, maybe the teacher-to-teacher program is a magnificent program, and maybe it's the solution. Well, bring it to the Joint Education Committee. Let's see what the peers have to say about it. And to my colleague, I've not seen the situation where teachers in Albany County have gone to junkets. In some instances, they do a cost analysis every time. The district does analysis. Is it better to send teachers off to a class or whether to bring a professional into the class and teach a greater number? And how do you share that information? But those are local decisions.
My wife is could come back to some, that was a great program, others, that was a dud. But those are local decisions, and those are fundamentally, the difficulty that I have is that for every dollar that went into one of those programs, one of the other programs were deprived of the dollars that you appropriated to accomplish it. And then we come back and we find out that things aren't, we're not moving forward in a data collection and with no capacity to say, did that work? What's going to work and where do we go next? And fundamentally, when you have a state of the state or state of education that says the legislature's got it wrong, we're not interested in helping them getting there, you can spend another year or two and we'll be right back here without the data, without the expertise to know whether or not the plans that we've implemented are in fact reaching it. With respect to the teacher turnover or staff turnover of 40%, it's now being offered as an excuse as to why you have to be 11 these positions. Fundamentally, you can't run this program the way we intend to with a 40% change in staff every time that we have an election. It just doesn't work. That 40% of people had a tremendous amount of education. I suspect this state paid millions of dollars for their education, their training dollars that are now gone. Many of these employees are at other agencies in the state, but they're not putting to use for us some of the skill sets that they had. We're talking about PhDs, master's people that had an enormous amount of expertise is just lost. And to suggest that the B-11 in its process is appropriate because you have this massive departure of 40% personnel, that's not what the budget provides. If you fund a position for a data technician or data entry, if that person leaves, you hire that same position. If you want to change the position, you need to come back to the legislature and say, we have a vacancy here, and we would like to recharacterize that vacancy. Or you use the B-11 process to do it. But this notion that if you have a large departure, that you can abandon the legislative characterization of the appropriation, I would liken it to authorizing a new judicial court in Johnson County. And then the court's coming back and saying, thank you very much. We like that position, but that position would be better suited in Laramie County, and we're going to move it to Laramie County because we think that's a greater need. If you think that's what your budgets are for, that's not what the Constitution is, and that's not what folks elected you to. With respect to the allocation of power, the power of the legislature is to set policies, devise programs, and implement and pay for the programs. And these programs were mostly legislative initiatives, many of them that we began after Campbell won. They're not, for the people that have been here, they're not big surprises. We know what the legislative programs because we initiated and we've been trying to get them implemented. And the power of the legislature is dependent upon the executive branch implementing our programs the way we specify with the funds that we've directed. And if you want to give up that power, you want to just say, look, we'll give a block grant, you can do that. There may be a delegation concern with the constitutionality of that. But in this instance, the governor, if you listen to his campaign, he campaigned on education too. And you go back and look at the information, the governor's in almost every election spend just as much time working on education issues as anything else. Why? Because, as our colleague from Casper says, it has repeatedly been the most important function of this state. All of us did. This is not a grab for power. Only elected folks are getting. It's a question of how you implement the legislative directives that we've implemented. With respect to the qualifications, I think it's a great idea. I think we just had a debate not too long ago about what the oil and gas commissioner has. We're capable of doing that. If we want to put minimum requirements, we should do that. But this is to suggest that somehow it's all complicated and it can't be done quickly. Folks, these are legislative initiatives we're talking about. They're programs that we devised, and they're not getting implemented, and we're not getting the data out. We're simply saying we're going to take our statutory programs that we start, and we'll assign those to a new department. It's not a shift in power. It's simply an insistence that when the legislature appropriates and creates a program, that the legislature directs the programs, we direct the funding. The difficulty is the power has been taken away from the legislature because programs are not being followed. The shift is an effort to say, I simply disagree with what the direction you've gone. And since I disagree, or because this department disagrees, we will take your funding and use it for other uses. We can't wait. I mean, if you want to wait another year, go through another night, we've been through two management audits. We've been through government reorganization. We know the problem. But we know one thing, and that is we were all elected to pass bills, to create programs, and to insist that we get returns for our money, and we can't do it unless we have essentially an acknowledgement that the Constitution says this is our role, and the role of the executive branch is to do our policy. And last year at this time, we sat here and in our budget, we said, look, this is the message. Don't do this program. This is what we're looking for. This is the expertise we've got. And we took some duties away to get some data collection. And here we are a year later. And instead of having, we got your message, we understand our role, we understand the legislative role, instead of getting that we had a whole year to get, we get the message that you should just establish broad parameters like graduation rates and go home, give us the money, we'll take care of it. We'll never get any place if we continue to go down this road.
Senator Hicks.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I rise in support of the sponsors of this bill, but I still have some overriding questions that I need some help with. And it comes back to the first question I ask, what I want to deal with is the presumptions that this bill is providing. What are we presuming that this is going to solve? And there's been a lot of talk about if we do this, the presumption is that we're going to fix the educational programs. But my question is because we want those to be number one in the United States, if we go through the handout here that states state government governance models, and I want you to pull that model out. There's already nine states that do what the proponents of the bill does. It says we're going to have the governor appoint this. Now, if we operate under the presumption that by passing this and then having a director of education, that this is going to all of a sudden increase the quality of the education, I would say then the data is already out there, and all we have to do is go to this model, number four, that you guys have a handout of the nine states that already do that. And if that's the case, by having a director improves the quality of education, then the data should be, so the question I have is, before second reading, if it makes it that far, can somebody provide me the information that shows that by having a director instead of an elected superintendent that we have a higher quality education? That's the first presumption. The second presumption that I'd like to try to address is this idea that if we have a director, that we're not going to run into the exact same problem. What happens when we have a director that's recalcitrant or resistant to following the budget director within the legislation? How long does it take to be able to develop the documents and the case and the history to show that we have a recalcitrant director? So my second question is what's the safeguard that you're not going to run into the director that institutes the same problems that we're dealing with right now? So those two presumptions, I guess I need some clarification on. That number one, if we have a director, that we're not going to run into some kind of recalcitrance and resistance that this is going to happen? And how long, if that's the case, does it take to develop that? And the first one is, just by implementing a director, do we improve the quality of education? Thank you.
Anyone else before one of the sponsors takes a final look? Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, just briefly and kind of speaking, hopefully from a 30,000-foot viewpoint on this, because I'm in the same situation that most of you have, maybe a little bit more because of some of the information we've been provided on appropriations. But, Mr. Chairman, if you always do what you've always done, then you'll always get what you always got. As we look at this, we need to make sure that as we look at this view, that our view with respect to this bill isn't about this year. It's not about next year. This is a bill that has the potential to be transformational, and it's about the next 20 years. And in doing that, Mr. Chairman, I would suggest there's a couple of things just from the 30,000-foot level that we ought to keep in mind. First one, Mr. Chairman, is probably, will public education be served better by an elected official whose only qualification is that they be an elector? They'd be eligible to vote. Or it will be better served by an appointed official who can, where there can be some professional credentials and experience be insisted upon that person's hire. I think also, as you look at this, if you believe about what, I think this also depends and will affect upon what you believe about local control. If you believe local control is where education should be, will this bill further enhance the ability of local school boards to manage and implement and develop and teach our kids? Because they're not taught at the state level, they're taught at the local level. So will this support or hamper your local control? I think one of the presumptions we have is when we have an elected official, it takes 4 to 8 years to correct a mistake if we have the wrong person in the job. I don't think that it takes that long because I'm assuming if we look at this, typically these directors serve at the pleasure of the governor. And certainly we have the ability to control that as this bill moves forward, if it moves forward, to flesh that out. And I think that's an incredibly important part of this bill is, one, what are the qualifications, and two, who's this person going to be appointed? Is this going to be at the pleasure of the governor? I think that's going to be important. I think if you believe that this is the appropriate way to do it, I would suggest to you that it's important that we do it quickly, and that that dragging this out for another year or two is not going to suffice. Let me give you a case in point. If you have a bank or financial institution that fails, if it gets below a certain point, the FDIC comes in and they'll walk into that bank in the middle of the week or on a work day. They shut the doors. They go through the books. They sell the assets. They reorganize the bank, and that bank is either closed or it's sold, and it opens up usually the next Monday. It opens up again for business. Is it sloppy? Is it hurt? Is it painful? Is it a painful process? Absolutely. This process, whether you vote for this bill or against this bill, is going to be a painful process. So voting on this bill, whether or not it hurts or whether it's awkward, is not an appropriate, I would suggest to you, is not an appropriate criteria. But it's simply, I think, when you look at it at the long term, if you believe this is the right thing to do, then it's important that it be done quickly. I think also when you look at this, one of the things I think you need to look at that, and goes back to presumption that my good friend from Carbon County just asked about, do you believe that this function, that by instituting a director, will that stabilize the Department of Education? Because that's the issue. The issue is the Department of, I'll give you an example. We'll just look at the turnover rate. We have a turnover rate in the last 2 years of over 40%. We have people who have developed, we've spent probably hundreds of thousands of dollars on gaining expertise in everything from curriculum to school finance to you name it, and they have, and the reports are that many of them no longer work for the Department of Education. These outstanding employees now work for other departments in education, and I'm sure the directors of those departments are happy to have them. But if you believe that instituting a director can stabilize that department in some manner, then you need to consider that. Again, I think this is about the long view, and if this is to be done, if you think this is the way that it's probably supposed to go, I would encourage you to consider doing it, because it's got to be done quickly. We can't prolong this. It's got to be done. We have to get on with it. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the other point I would make is I think this bill deserves further consideration. I think it deserves the opportunity to provide some amendments for some good points that have been brought up. And I would encourage the body to vote for it and move it along. If you don't like it today, you can always vote against it on third reading. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'll ask you for your strong consideration of at least moving this forward so it continues to have the opportunity to progress and go through the refining process.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Cole.
I want to thank everybody for their discussion today. I thought it was worthwhile. I want to remind everybody of the key thing that this bill does do. And there's things to talk about. There's things to talk about the director. There's the things, other things to talk about out there. There's amendments that we can bring. A good senator from Glen Rock has an idea on some stuff. And I'd ask that you move this bill along. I feel strongly, very strongly, that if we don't do something now, education accountability will not proceed. I really believe that. And I want you to know that the entire Education Accountability Committee is on this bill. This bill didn't come out lightly. This is not a co-bill acting on a vendetta. I mean, I've had these emails, you know, that tell me that garbage. That's not what's going on here. Look at the sponsors on this bill. So with that, I want to thank everybody for the discussion today. The hour's late, and I'd call for the question.
Question has been called. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 104, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no.
No.
Senate File 104 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Division has been called. All in favor, please rise. All opposed, please rise.
Yes.
Senate File 104 has passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? No. Motion passes. Mr. President.
Reports from Standing Committee.
No,
what?
Oh,
wait.
Yeah.
The reading clerk will read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 5, do pass amended. Senate File 8, do pass. Senate File 13, do pass. Senate File 30, do pass amended. Senate File 31, do pass amended. Senate File 64, do pass. And Senate File 104, do pass amended. Senator Landon, Chairman.
Senator Landon.
Mr. President, I would move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Now reports from Standing Committee.
January the 10th, 2013, Mr. President, your Committee Number 5, Agricultural State Public Lands and Water Resources, to whom was referred Senate File 7, Conservation District Special Expertise. Reports back with the recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Driscoll, Emmerich, Geis, Hicks, and Johnson, Senator Geis, Chairman. January the 14th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 2, Oil and Gas Conservation Commission Filings. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Anderson 2, Senators Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Rothfuss, Senator Hines, Chairman. January the 14th, 2013, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 27, Limited Mining Operations. Reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Anderson, 02, Cole, Cooper, Hines, and Ruffstuff, Senator Hines, Chairman.
Mr. Majority, is there anything else? Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Mr. President, I move that we stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January the 15th.
The announcement, Senator Geis.
Committee number 5, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, will meet tomorrow night upon adjournment. We're going to take up Senate File 4, Livestock Disease Reporting and Liability, Senate File 66, State-Funded Conservation Easement Restrictions, Senate File 69, Ominous Water Bill Construction.
Senator Ron Flater.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number 8, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet at 10 minutes till 6 in room S14 to consider Senate File 51, Federal Motor Carrier Safety Act Compliance, Senate File 78, Active Duty Medical Cost Reimbursement Program Amendments, and Senate File 74, Professional Licensing Military Spouses.
Mr. Vice President.
Thank you, Mr. President. Mr. President, your committee number 2, Appropriations, will meet at 5:45 in the JAC to, hopefully, if they're still around, talk about county and prosecuting attorneys and some callbacks. We'll meet in the morning at 8 a.m., continue our budget hearings, and the Joint Appropriations Committee 214 will start with the Office of Public Defender.
Further announcements. Where's Senator Burns? No, I'm just kidding. You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We stand adjourned until 10 a.m. Tuesday, January 15th.